Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with Chris Palm, CWA member and former organizer, about the strike that's going on again, day 9 of the defense of the middle class. Look, I've been saying all along, if these 45,000 workers, if they end up having this horrible contract, these horrible concessions rammed down their throats, we're all going to lose in this. Somebody at some point in time has to say enough is enough. We're going to stand up to these extremely profitable corporations and say, you know what? We want what it is that we create, and that's wealth. I think too often workers don't really understand the value of what it is that they do. You know, for too long, what's happened is we've gotten into this mentality of, you know, I'll take whatever the job, whatever, just so I have a job. And I'm just thankful to have a job. And yes, cut my benefits and cut my health care and cut my, give me one of those crappy 401ks and, you know, cut wages, all of that, make me work harder, but I'm just happy to have a job. At some point, that stops. At some point, people say enough is enough. And I think the folks at CWA, and we'll talk about this with Chris Palm, you know, have enough. You know, you've got to stand up, fight back, and say enough. So it'll be good to talk to him in the first hour. In the second hour, Ian Millhiser, policy analyst and blogger over at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. He's going to be here talking about Rick Perry. He, you know, on Saturday announced his big run. Now we're going to find out what, you know, now that you're in the race there, Rick, we're going to find out every dirty little secret. And the first couple of things that popped right out. All the minimum wage jobs, you know, he can claim he created 40% of all the jobs in the country. The majority of them are minimum wage. I must have gotten 10 emails over the weekend going, hey, you know, these are all minimum wage jobs. Look at this. And then the other thing I got the emails for, he could be our first closeted gay president. I've got a bunch of emails, and I'm not saying it's true, but that seems to be the rumor from folks along the blogosphere. So that'll be interesting to talk to Ian Millhiser about that. And really, to Ian, I think his focus, since he is a constitutional guy, he does his work, focuses on the Constitution. And take a look at some of the bizarre things Perry has said over the years about Social Security and Medicare and, you know, basically all of our laws being unconstitutional. Interesting. And also in the second hour, Paul Clark, professor of labor studies over at Penn State University, going to be here talking about the No Rights at Work agenda that tomorrow is going to be on the plate. Tomorrow, 1 o'clock in the Capitol, they're going to be looking at Mad Cow's House Bill 50, 51, 52, and 53. That's the No Rights at Work agenda. That's to strip your right to collective bargaining away from you. Make Pennsylvania one of those work right to work for less states. You know, give you the right to, you know, to slit your own throat. So good stuff there. Had a great weekend. Thanks to the folks in Cleveland who emailed me and gave me a bunch of ideas on things to do. I went home to visit family, even went and caught an Indians game. and the baseball gods not happy. They were not happy I was in the park. In fact, as soon as the game started, the sky opened up, and it basically just fell. Nothing but buckets of rain. It was, they weren't even rain drops. They were like rain buckets. And the thunder and lightning and the whole thing. So we left pretty much after it started. Eventually the game was canceled, was postponed. Beautiful baseball field, beautiful place. Wish we could have stayed and seen the game, but had a great time back in Cleveland. Visited a couple of picket lines. When the Rite Aid workers were here, we had their president from Local 880, UFCW, into the studio talking about that. And I went out and visited the picket lines and, you know, basically talked to these folks who have been on strike for almost a little over a year, I think it is. And what a difference a couple of miles makes. While I was standing there talking to these folks, you didn't see people going past their picket line. In fact, I saw a couple people pull up going, there's a strike going on? Like, well, they didn't know. And they said, yeah, and they just kept driving. They were going to go into that store, change their mind. And, you know, there's part of me that says we need to be doing more of that. And one of my suggestions for the Verizon folks is maybe you start picketing the Verizon stores. And you start talking to the people who are their customers who are going in and out. That, I think, because we have to go back to a time. Where crossing a picket line was seen as something negative, where if someone called you a scab, that was really something. And you know, back home in Cleveland, there's still some of that because there are a lot of people who have some attachments to labor. And you know, in talking to these people, they've gotten such great support from the community. It's just that the corporations, these big corporate entities, they see now as the time that they can just eviscerate the working class, that they can steal back years of gains, they can steal back years of benefits. And, you know, Verizon came out with this three-page spread that they put into newspapers, which, again, massive money, huge amounts of money that they're pouring into trying to deny these people health care, trying to deny these people a whole bunch of stuff, a little security, reasonable pension, reasonable health care. And you look at all the money they're pouring into this campaign, and I'm told that they're hiring scabs for $35 an hour. And I'm going, if you're willing to pay a scab who doesn't know the job $35 an hour, why aren't you paying the guy that actually works for you and produces for you? But they came out and they came out with this three-page ad. And, you know, it's, well, you know, they claim, the union claims that we're asking the union employees to contribute to their own health care premiums. And in big, bold letters, they're right. They're proud of the fact that they want their employees to make less money. They're proud of the fact that their non-union, the 135,000 non-union members, non-union workers that they have, pay a larger portion of their health care, make less wages. They're proud of that. They're proud of the fact that they were able to get these 135,000 non-union employees to accept lower wages and lower benefits, telling me that there are 135,000 people who don't think they're worth very much. But they're all in favor. This is great. They're right. We're going to fight that. And it goes on, you know, they claim we're proposing union employees do more for our customers. Every union member you talk to, hold on. we want to do what's best for our customers, but we don't want to be put into a situation where if I have to take a couple of extra minutes talking to a customer on the phone, I'm going to get docked. This whole thing, what they're trying to do is they're trying to make, when you call customer service, trying to make that a production line where they pump out your phone call in 90 seconds. They pump out your phone call in 2 minutes. When, you know, hey, I got questions. I don't want somebody, sorry, 90 seconds up, click, which is what it'll turn into. But they think that's fair. They think that's fair. They think a lot of things are fair. They said that the Verizon's ad, the final pages, they claim we want to strip away 50 years of contract negotiations. And the big red letters, they're right, we do. Because, you know, 50 years ago our business was different. Yeah, but that has changed. And the negotiations have changed, and the job titles, and they've worked together. Again, they're taking this adversarial role, and the workers haven't. They want to work. They've said that. And what I find really amazing is that they've spent all of this money, all of this energy trying to deny these folks when they could just sit down at the bargaining table. And this strike, as I understand it, was called specifically to get them back to the table. Fact of the matter is, before the workers went on strike, the company had missed, had said, you know, we're not coming to the table. We're just not. So what are you left with? Well, they were left with saying, you know what, we're gonna jumpstart the negotiations. And I support them 100%. I hope you do too. So when we go around, we see these folks on the picket line, we're gonna stop and say hello and tell them we support them. But back home, a little different. You know, I met the folks on the picket line there at the Rite Aid, and you know, just great folks, just trying to fight for reasonable benefits. And that's really what it's about. In talking to them, it's the health care costs. So I take that back to the reality of, you know, if we had national health care, most of our labor problems would end. You got the president going, well, labor and management shouldn't fight so much. Get us national health care, and they probably wouldn't. But for me, I got to be honest. I think seeing the resurgence of strikes, seeing people walking a picket line again, I think is going to draw awareness to the fact that somebody is tired of getting the short end of the stick. And the reality is there's only so much of it you're willing to be force-fed before you stand up and fight back. But I got to be honest, you know, going back to Cleveland just kind of depressed me to no end. You know, the roads, the bridges, the infrastructure. The main road going down to where the Rite Aid was hasn't been paved in at least 40 years. I mean, they weren't potholes. They were craters. And you look down in what used to be industrial areas, all the closed factories, and they're not closed because of competition. You know, the right leaders say, well, we can't compete. That's one of these factors. No, that wasn't it. These places are closed because of policy. These places are closed because we keep following these bizarre free trade schemes that force those companies to go overseas and then reward them to bring the stuff back. That's what it's about. And everybody I talk to, you know, people want to work. It's about jobs. That whole debt thing didn't matter. And it doesn't matter to people who are about to lose their homes. What they want to have jobs. And to me, you know, you look at the crumbling nature of our infrastructure, especially when I went back home. I mean, it is just, it's sad. I mean, it is really sad, the state of our infrastructure. Because I took the back way going to Cleveland. And you see these communities that are basically boarded up along the roads. The roads are in bad shape. The infrastructure is struggling. And I think people are looking to Washington. People are looking to their state capitals and are not seeing anything getting done. And we've got to start making things here again. And I know I've been saying that for the longest time, but, you know, it really struck home when I went to visit my grandmother in Cleveland and just saw all of the what was an industrial power, just a skeleton of what it was. And you look at the fact that over the weekend, I don't know if you saw this thing with the Indiana State Fair where the stage collapsed. Evidently, it was never inspected. Evidently, they don't do that. They don't have a person who inspects temporary structures. And I am like, really? You don't have a person who does that? Because originally I thought, well, the stands came down or something permanent came down. And, well, here's another example of our crumbling infrastructure. No, it wasn't that. What it is it, we just don't regulate that. So there are 5 people dead and there are 45 people that they've said are injured because evidently we don't do that. And I ask you, how much more deregulation do we need? How much more non-regulation do we need? Anyway, it is day 9. The Verizon workers are on the picket line. When we come back, we're going to talk with Chris Palm, CWA member and former organizer, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this talk with Chris.
Can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Communications Workers of America and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers have filed unfair labor practice charges against Verizon, charging that the company has refused to bargain in good faith. The unions want the NLRB to immediately order Verizon to negotiate in good faith as labor law requires. Some 45,000 CWA and IBEW Verizon workers have been on strike since August 7th. The highly profitable Verizon is demanding $1 billion in concessions, $20,000 per working family there. Verizon has gotten court injunctions in several states that limit picketing. Bill Huber is business manager of IBEW Local 827, one of the striking locals at Verizon.
It's clear to myself. myself and the other leaders of the unions that what Verizon is attempting to do is just break the unions.
Huber says Verizon is not merely asking for a bigger contribution to health care costs. It's gutting 50 years of collective bargaining gains. And he says the American public should rally to the strikers' cause. Why? Because it's a battle in defense of the American middle class.
They're not interested in bargaining with us. They're not interested in compromise. They're interested in gutting. We're just on a path to destroy middle America. We need the public to reach out to their politicians. Stop greedy companies like Verizon that make significant money here. Stop them from breaking the back of the middle class America. Because if they win, if they're successful at this, the United States, we're down to two. Because everybody else is going to follow this pattern.
The U.S. Postal Service is urging Congress to gut collective bargaining rights for postal workers so 120,000 workers can be laid off. The Postal Service cites a huge $8 billion deficit as the motive for its attack on workers, but a congressional mandate enacted in the Bush administration forces the Postal Service to pre-fund 75 years' worth of retiree health benefits. That mandate alone costs $5.5 billion a year, and it's imposed only on the Postal Service. Lifting that mandate, or allowing pension surpluses to be applied to those retiree health benefits, would wipe out the deficit and avoid the massive layoffs. Sally Davidow is a spokesperson for the American Postal Workers Union. She says this big lie that the postal deficit is a result of union workers is an effort to use the cover of a crisis for hostile action against workers, with privatization of the Postal Service the possible ultimate goal.
Certainly for some of these ultra-right-wing congressmen, I do think that is the goal. Clearly an attempt to take a crisis and try and use it to advance an ideological agenda that's hostile to workers. The same law that implemented the pre-funding requirement said the Postal Service could not raise prices over the rate of inflation. If you say they can't raise prices and then you give them a $5.5 billion bill every single year for 10 years, what's the effect going to be? It's going to destroy the Postal Service.
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company, and by OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America, 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. It was on this day back in 1989 that a man named Gary Horrigan, the chief steward of CWA Local 1103 and NYNEC striker in Vahalia, New York, was struck on the picket line by a car driven by the daughter of the plant manager. Sadly, he died the next day, leaving a wife and two small daughters. And, you know, you look at these things and you hope and you pray that it never has to come to this. You never have to go out on the picket line. But sometimes you don't have a choice. And you look back in 1989, that four-month strike back then was over health care benefits. You know, if we could do something about that. Anyway, we are in day nine of the CWA strike. So I've asked Chris Palm, a CWA member and a former organizer, come talk to us a little bit. Chris, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me, Rick. I really appreciate what you do.
So here we are, day nine of the strike. How are things going?
Things are going well. We are picketing every Verizon location from Massachusetts down to Virginia, both Verizon corporate offices, Verizon plant offices, and Verizon wireless stores.
I'm seeing all these YouTube videos popping up of these scabs going to, or I'm sorry, the replacement scabs going to different job sites doing work. I got to be honest with you. I fear for their safety. I fear for the safety of the public. And I can't believe that somebody hasn't stepped in to put a stop. I mean, the one video showed a guy blowing up a transformer on a light pole. I'm surprised he didn't get killed.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of what I've seen on the YouTube videos are, in fact, unsafe working practices, practices that me and my fellow coworkers would be disciplined for. And a lot of these folks are out there breaking our safety practices every day.
So I'm looking at these videos, and the response that I see from the company, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the response that I see is not, oh, gee, how do we make these jobs safer? How do we get qualified people out doing these jobs? But if you're in telling these scabs, if they're in the videos, that they can somehow, you know, file suit to get the videos taken down.
That's the rumor that I've heard. That's the rumor that I've heard, that if you believe that your face or your likeness is one of these videos that the company has put out methods, means and methods to have these videos removed from YouTube.
As I understand this, we're looking at the company has put 100 demands on the table. They've pulled one, I understand, one off, and that's all the movement that we've gotten to this point, 9 days into the strike.
That's what I understand, too. Rick, we started bargaining on July 22nd, and the same 100 demands from the company are still on the table, except for the one that you're referring to. Talks from the company, from union representatives, are that the company is not at a position where they're willing to back down. So we are, again, we're out in full force, fighting 110%, picketing every location we can, urging everybody to contact their friends, their families, their neighbors, letting them know what is going on, what the company's trying to strip from us, and urging them to support the union.
This is a very profitable company.
Very profitable company. Very profitable company. I've got some figures that I'll share with you that I was able to retrieve offline. In 2007, the first year of the contract that has expired now, it started in 2007, $5.5 billion. The following year, 2008, $6.4 billion. 2009, $11.6 billion. And in 2010, $10.2 billion. So up to the point of the contract expiration, we've helped Verizon make $28.2 billion over the last 3 years.
And that is the labor that you and your coworkers have put in. Because I've taken the position that, you know, I was looking at the three-page ad that Verizon put out. And they were talking about, yes, we want our people to pay more for health care like the non-union people do. And my position is you know, is it that you guys have it too well, or that those guys who, those 135,000 non-union members, don't really know what the value of their labor is to this company?
I think they don't have any idea, any clue as to what the value of their labor is. Rick, we do contribute. There's some misconstrued facts out there that CWA does not contribute to their benefits. And in actuality, we do. We contribute 7% to our benefits. And in comparison, the non-union side just really has no idea as to the value that they are and the worth that they are to this company and how much money this company does actually make on all of our backs and shoulders.
So let me ask you this. One of the things that they've put out in their three-page ad is that they want, you know, they want the union employees to do more for their customers. I think that's a slap in the face.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We are told from day one in this company that customer service is number one. We go out there as a union to provide a quality service for our customers. Customers are number one to us. That is why we get our paychecks. Our paychecks are brought to us by our customers, and we each and every one of us appreciate and know that, strive every day to improve customer service within this company.
See, I find it interesting is that they're saying we want them to do more for their customers. Yet the numbers you just ticked off, the profits that they've made, that kind of tells me that they must be doing something right to have gotten that kind of profit margin.
Absolutely, absolutely. We are doing what's right out there. This company is taking customers left and right from all of our competitors, and yet they want us to do more. I don't know where that more would come from, Rick. We go out there and strive every day, as I said, to provide the best level of customer service we possibly can. Some of what Verizon has talked about in the newspapers and to the press is that we don't, as the unionized side of the business, don't produce that much income for the business. Yet we go out there and we are in a saturated Fios market. We produce DSL, copper telephone lines, to which people use every single day.
But
they
Chris,
want to say that wireless is the only profitable side of this business, and I contest that.
But Chris, all I keep hearing is that what you guys do is that old stuff, that old string with the two cups on the end.
Yeah, that's what they say. You know, in actuality, Rick, without Verizon, the Verizon, the core side of the business, cell phones would not even operate. The way a cell phone call works, in very plain terms, cell phone call is made, hit cell phone tower, then goes buried through a fiber optic piece of cable that the unionized employees maintain and operate through a central office, then back through the same path the other direction to the returning call or the incoming call. Without us, without the unionized side of the business, Verizon Wireless would not operate. They would not be able to work. The network, the infrastructure is maintained, produced, and operated by Verizon unionized employees.
You know, let me ask you this. You know, I've been watching these videos, and I go back to the days when I was on strike. The happiest people that I knew when the strike ended when I was on strike back in 94 were the frontline supervisors who had to go and do my job. In looking at these videos, do you think maybe this will be one of those moments that the people that you were working for directly above you now understand and appreciate how difficult it is what you do? Or is this just going to be something that passes by them?
I think that they have an appreciation at this point, or should have an appreciation at this point, of what we do go through, you know, going out every day and servicing the customer in all types of weather conditions. You know, it's been raining, it's been lightning. I would hope that they would have some appreciation for what we do.
Has CWA mocked up any numbers of how much this strike is costing them per day by hiring? Like I said, I heard somewhere that they're hiring scabs for $35 an hour. I watched the one guy, they said for an hour it took him to get the ladder off the truck. So there's $35 of not actually doing a job that they're paying. But have there been any numbers thrown around of how much this is costing them and what the dollar cost benefit would be of just signing a contract and moving forward?
Not that I'm aware of, Rick, although what I can tell you is, and this may be a small figure in the large scheme of things, that just the injunction that was placed on the striking union members in Dauphin County alone, there was a $10,000 bond placed on that. And that's more than likely, and this is an assumption, but more than likely produced in every county in the state across the whole strike turf. So just for the injunction alone in Dauphin County, the company spent $10,000.
Wow. And that seems to me to be just wasted money. Something you could have sat down and negotiated this out and really come to an agreement. Is it, because I'm looking at this and I'm going, I really don't think Verizon wants an agreement. I think they want to be able to get rid of you guys, bring in independent contractors, and continue what U.S. businesses across this country have done for the last 10, 20 years.
In fact, Rick, I agree with your point. And in fact, what they're doing is I believe, is trying to break this union. This is very Wisconsin-esque type bargaining. They have stated in their bargaining, and one of the things that we are trying to accomplish in this contract is to maintain the workers in this country. But they've stated that they have the plans of offshoring 25,000 customer service jobs.
So if they get their way, I could be calling Verizon for customer service and end up talking to someone in India or Pakistan or Malaysia or who knows where.
At least 25,000 jobs, yes. That's what I'm on the understanding of, yes.
And here
they
again.
They do want to contract out the people that come and knock on your doors. That's what I do. I'm a services technician. I do residential, small business repair, maintenance, and installation. I'm the guy that comes to your door and knocks on the door when you have a problem. I'm here local in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. That is the turf I work in. I would be replaced with a contractor, somebody who is making far less money than me, who has far less knowledge than me. I've been on the job for 13 years at this point and have worked this job for that period of time and have acquired quite a bit of skill and knowledge.
Let me ask you this last question I've got for you. You know, as this moves down the road, what's this doing to your family right now, and what's this going to do as you move down the road? How's this going to affect? I know you have children. How's this going to affect you?
I do. I have two small children. I have a daughter that's 5 and a son that's 2. It has affected us tremendously. We had anticipated the strike, so we do have some savings, but that savings has gone through pretty quickly, even in the 9 days that we've been out. My wife has currently just lost her job in these wonderful economic times. She had just lost her job, and I've had to go out and get extra work. But in spite of that fact, I've been on the picket line every day fighting for this cause. I will not fight. I will go one day longer than the company, and I'm not willing to go back. 50 years of bargaining is on the table right now, and I'm willing to stand up and fight for my union and fight for my brothers and sisters until this is seen through.
And we're right there with you, Chris Palm. I appreciate your time. Keep up the faith, brother. We're right here with you.
Thanks, Rick.
Chris Palm, CWA member and former organizer there. Again, to me, this is that battlefront. This is the front line of the class war right now. If these petty dictators can get away with this to people like Chris and his co-workers, we're all next. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
3,000 people screaming out, "Where's our government?" Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance, public divided into their love before they hate it. Rocket billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have took into account
that we never give up.
We'll be here one day longer. The people's voice is stronger.
We
got a cause for our money. We will talk with respect. Keep fighting for these rights, the generation that's next. One day longer.
Class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm often asked, do Republicans serve any real purpose in Congress? Yes, they do. They proudly serve as the plodding pack mules of corporate America, dutifully hauling any load that a corporation piles on their backs, no matter how odious. Take Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, whose back is permanently swayed from 34 years of carrying corporate legislation. Most recently, he's been toting a stinky load for Delta and other airlines that want Congress to rig their employees' unionization elections by decreeing that those who choose not to vote be counted as having voted against unionization. To get what his corporate drivers wanted, the mulish Hatch went to extremes this summer. He held the Federal Aviation Administration's budget hostage for nearly 2 weeks, forcing this essential public safety agency to lay off 4,000 employees and halt an array of airport improvement projects across the country, idling tens of thousands of construction workers. Braying and kicking, the senator from Delta was perfectly willing for this destructive shutdown to continue through August, even as he and other lawmakers went on vacation. But less obstinate Republicans intervened with a patchwork deal that lets the FAA operate until mid-September. After that, who knows? But what about airline safety, you ask? Hatch showed that he didn't care, but luckily for us, key agency workers did. Dozens of FAA safety inspectors volunteered to stay on duty during Hatch's shutdown, even though they were not being paid and were even having to use their personal credit cards to cover their on-the-job travel expenses. If only senators had such a sense of responsibility. This is Jim Hightower saying, remember, these public-spirited employees are some of the same government workers who are denigrated as slugs and leeches by the Orrin Hatches of our country.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? The Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Fed sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, just download the Stitcher app. You can take your class war on the go. Our stat of the day from the Too Much Online blog. Americans by a 2-to-1 margin want to see the rich paying higher taxes. And who's saying that? Well, There was a national Gallup poll released last week that we had talked about, saying, quote, the increasing income taxes for upper Americans, the policy option enjoyed overwhelming support by Democrats, independents, and even Republicans. 47% said, you know what, we need to raise taxes on the very wealthy. And right in line with what I've been saying for the longest time. Let's go to the phones. We got Bill Castle on line one. How are we doing tonight, Bill?
Good. And you guys?
Just hanging in there, fighting the fight.
Cool.
How are things going for you guys?
It's going as well as can be expected. We're showing a lot of unity, a lot of strength on our lines, trying to get our message across.
And what kind of support, what kind of reaction are you getting from the public? Are you getting much, are you getting support? Are you seeing any blowback? What are you seeing?
Oh, for the most part, I'd say 99% of the folks that drive by, they're honking in support. Everybody I've talked to understands why we're out here. Maybe they're getting a bigger picture that it's not just about our contract. Definitely support all around the board. You know, with anything, you're going to have a couple of hecklers in there, but I'd say, again, 99% support.
Because in the time when I was out walking on your line, the people that I had the opportunity to talk to, I think they get it. They understand that you're really on the front line of this fight. You're on the front line of the class war, if you will. Because if you go down, we're all going to come down with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that many of these other companies that have union employees are looking to find out what this outcome is going to be. Because I can guarantee you, if they feel as though they can get us, every other union employee, every other union is going to be on the block. And then as soon as they wipe out unions, if they would ever get that done, I can guarantee you every other worker out here is going to see a decrease in their wages, an increase in what they pay for benefits, and simply worse working conditions than they currently have.
And that's the goal. I mean, you know, one of the things I like to say about Rick Perry is, you know, he wants to take us back to the 90s, the 1890s. Repeal the entire 20th century and back to the good old days where there were two classes of people, the handful of very, very wealthy, and then the rest of you people at the bottom who know your place.
Absolutely.
And that's why I'm saying, you know, this is, to me, something that we have to fight through. And I give you guys the ultimate credit for, in these economic times, saying, you know, we're not going to dicker around. We're going to take it right to the line, and we're going to go and we're going to fight right from the beginning.
Absolutely. The line has been drawn. I mean, realistically, I don't feel as though we had any other choice but to stand in opposition to what this company is demanding from us.
Well, as I understood it, they didn't come to the bargaining table for several days. What choice are you left with?
Exactly.
I mean, they're pushing because, you know, in looking at this story top to bottom, to me it looks like they just want to they want to replace everybody. They want to put in independent contractors. They basically want to shift the burden onto the backs of those least able to burden it, the workers.
I agree.
So as we move forward, what kind of things you got planned for this week?
Well, we're going to be having a starting at 7:30 Wednesday evening. We're going to start over at City Island. We're going to meet as a group, and then we're going to walk over to Strawberry Square. We'll be wearing black, carrying illuminary devices, basically as a representation, for mourning the loss of our contract at the moment. Of course, we're going to continue our picket locations and ramp it up specifically at the Verizon Wireless stores.
All righty. Well, I look forward to that, and I wish you guys nothing but the best of luck, and love to have you back. Give us an update early and often.
Will do. Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you.
You know, I look at this, and again, it comes back to the reality of this right here is where we're going to have to fight this. And the hope is that these folks can hold out long enough to get a contract that's going to, you know, be reasonable. Nobody's talking. And this is the thing. Nobody on the picket line was talking unreasonable stuff. I want $100 an hour. There's none of that. No. They want to maintain the standard of living they have.
It's like they said in a nice article in the Harrisburg, Rick. And one of the workers in the picket line said, it's not about money. He said they could, you know, they could easily afford to double our salaries. It's not about that. It's about saving the middle class. They're talking about, and one of our guests talked about it, outsourcing some of the jobs. It's about jobs, and it's about the middle class. It's about what corporate America is doing. And at some point, workers have to, and I think these people have. They've drawn a line in the sand and said, no, we are not going to budge. This is where we choose to stand and fight.
And that's why we stand with them. But here's the thing. You know, I look around, and some of the folks that I've talked to, you know, and I've been talking to a lot of people about this strike here. I've been talking to people about the lockouts that have been going on. And, you know, most people, they got their heads down. They're just trying to get through the day, just trying to hold on to what they've got. Just, you know, I mean, people are so busy, so overworked, so overburdened. And the more of this, you know, and I think most people I talk to are just happy that it's not them right now. But I think there's a sense that they know if it's not me now, it will be eventually. And, you know, when I keep talking about taxing the rich, and you're, well, you're talking about class war. And you're absolutely right. I'm one of the few people who will say there is absolutely positively a class war going on right now. You know, Warren Buffett said it. His class is winning. But no one in the working class is saying, well, there's a class war going on. Yes, there is. And we're getting our hats handed to us. And what the reality is, I don't really think that we have a firm grasp of how much the wealth class has taken from us. I don't think we get how much they've pocketed for themselves at our expense. Now, look, I'm not talking about being jealous of the Joneses down the street who put in that nice pool, or the Smiths down the street who got the nice big screen TV. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the billionaire who goes out and buys himself an island so he can get away from the rabble. I'm talking about the billionaire who buys the 500-foot yacht so he can be a global citizen, so he doesn't have to worry about helping those people. And the reality is, you know, Warren Buffett gets it. You know, he understands. He understands how he got to be rich. He also understands that he's not going to get any richer if we get poorer. And he wrote a piece... I wrote a piece in the New York Times titled Stop Coddling the Super Rich. And, I mean, it's a fantastic piece. And if it were written by anyone other than Warren Buffett, it would be it would be taken apart. If you look at a couple of quick facts, you look at the fact that the richest 20% of the people in this country own 84% of all the wealth. That's scary. That's telling me that 80% have 16%, and that the vast majority of them are living in poverty. And in this day and age, there should be no one, no American citizen in this, nobody here living in poverty. Nobody. But Buffett lays it out. He says, look, you know, our leaders have asked for shared sacrifice. But when they did the asking, they spared me. And he says, I checked with my mega-rich friends to learn what pain they were expecting, and they, too, were left untouched. And he goes into what we've been talking about for the longest time. The capital gains rate at 15% is an absolute crime. The fact that there are people taking $1 billion, paying a 15% rate, is criminal. And he goes in, he says, look, he said, you know what, my federal tax bill last year was almost $7 million. Almost $7 million. He said, I paid a 17.4% tax rate. That's what he paid. And he doesn't do any of the deductions. He doesn't have the high-priced attorneys who go after every loophole. That's just what he paid. I mean, he basically did the easy form for billionaires. He says, you know, the people in my office, the other 20 people that work in my office, their tax rates were between 33 and 41%, averaged 36%. These aren't billionaires. These are secretaries. These are office people. Here's the billionaire paying 17%. Here's everybody else paying 36% federal tax. You don't see a problem there? And he's saying, look, you know, the reality is tax me. There's a problem. We need roads. We need bridges. We need infrastructure. We need an education system. We need. So take from us and take care of those needs. And he points out something that we've talked about on this show numerous times, that last year about 80% of the revenues that came into government, 80% of the revenues came from personal income taxes, from payrolls. You know, you and I, we work, we pay taxes. He said the mega rich, you know, the people who paid the at the 15% rate, most of their earnings were in that rate. They paid 15%. That's it. That's what the revenue came from. And he said, you know, we should be making them pay more because they're not working. They're investing. And he said, look, I do that too. What I found interesting in his article, though, is he says, look, higher tax rates aren't going to stop me. In the 80s and 90s, when the tax rates were much higher, I still invested. You know, in 1976, 77, when the capital gains rates were almost 40%, he said, I still invested. You're not going to shy away from a sensible investment, he says, because of the tax rate. Either you're going to make money on it or you're not. So this whole, and it's what I've been saying for the longest time, this whole tax thing is just a charade. It's a ruse. But he goes through something else that I've, again, this is all stuff we've talked about on the program. He says, since 1992, the IRS has compiled data from the returns of the 400 biggest income earners, those heavy 400. In 1992, they had an aggregate taxable income of almost $17 billion. They paid taxes at about a 29.2% rate. So you had, you know, the top 400, almost $17 billion in their pocket. They paid a little over 29%. In 2008, the numbers that he has, those 400 had an aggregate income, and again, you know, you look at this and you go, holy wow, almost $91 billion, a staggering $227 million apiece on average. They paid 21.5% interest, or percent, income tax. So we're seeing them getting wealthier, 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 paying less and less. And that, to me, I got to be honest, is scary stuff, especially when he points out that 88 of the 400 reported no wages at all. All they had were capital gains. They don't have jobs. They just invest. Think about that. So as he's pointing out, he said, look, we need to raise taxes on that 2%. Leave the tax rates where they are for everybody else, but those 2%, the heavy 200, the heavy 2%, those are the folks we tax. Anybody making over $1 million, of which there are over 236,000, we tax them at a higher rate. The people who are making over $10 million, we tax them, because you know, we got people making over, we got, what, 9,500 people making over $10 million a year? And I go back to the Schakowsky bill. That's what we should be talking about. We're going to take a quick break, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated, professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280, or visit our website at teamsterslocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by loading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You can email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. You got a question, comment, something on your mind. Bill sent me this email with a story from the guy, considered, I guess, one of the most liberal politicians in all of Utah. He was the former mayor of Salt Lake City, a guy named Rocky Anderson, who I think we've had on the program at some point, a couple years ago, maybe. But anyway, he says the headline is the former Salt Lake mayor, Rocky Anderson, divorces himself from gutless Democratic Party. And I'm like, finally, somebody who said it. We need to really begin to look at the party and say, folks, grow a spine. And that's basically what he said. He said, look, I'm done with the Democratic Party. He was on Amy Goodman's show a couple years ago. He said, I put my proud Democrat mug into storage. He says, now I think I'll just throw it in the garbage and be done with it. And, you know, again, you know, you see some of this stuff and how they cave and how they're always giving. Finally, somebody's saying, you know what? We need somebody who's got a spine. Anderson says, I think the answer is a new political party that actually will advocate for and promote the interests of the public rather than their own interests of the wealthy who bought and paid for not only Congress, but the White House. And look, at the end of this, it is the money. And this is what I've been saying for the longest time. Until we can figure out how to make total disclosure available to when the Koch brothers spend money on you know, these front groups, or they spend money to go after a politician, until we know who's spending that money, there's no way of stopping this. Both parties are feeding at the same trough because they're both feeding the same animal, which is the television market. And until we figure out how to fix that, I'm a fan of publicly financed elections. I'm a fan of saying, you know what, you want to be a TV station, you got to give politicians X amount of time for airtime to be able to get their message out. It is, after all, they are our airwaves, correct? Well, in theory. He goes on to say in his email, he says, how dare you send an email with the subject line standing strong. Evidently, the DCCC sent out this email asking for money with standing strong in the byline. He says, you didn't do it on Iraq. You didn't do it on torture. You didn't do it on signing statements. You haven't done it in Afghanistan. You haven't done it on defense spending. You haven't done it on real health care reform. You haven't done it on the energy policy or the climate crisis. You haven't done it on the evisceration of our system of checks and balances through the invocation of the state secret doctrine, and you haven't done it on the debt ceiling fiasco. He goes on to say that he wants no part of the Democratic Party until it shows some spine and draws a line in the sand and ends the tax breaks for the wealthy that need to be part of any debt slash budget bill. He said the Constitution has been eviscerated while Democrats stood by with nary a whimper. It is a gutless, unprincipled party, he said, bought and paid for by the same interests that buy and pay for the Republican Party. And you know what? I don't know how you can argue, Jake.
Well, I think you and I could add a couple other things that were deeply disappointing from labor's perspective. I guess we can sign that man up for the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, and that's exactly what they need. Now, He threw out the third party, and that sounds like a nice alternative. I mean, there were people in labor talking about a labor party, but unfortunately, because of our society and the makeup and the interest in the controlling interest of money, if we set up a labor party, all we would do is basically weaken the Democratic vote, unfortunately.
But, what, you know, again, you know, you look at that, I understand the guy's frustration because I'm there too.
Oh, I am too.
Do you keep doing the same thing over and over again, backing a party that really doesn't hold your values dear, that will sell you out at the drop of a hat? That's the question that some are having right now.
And here's the quandary. Here's the quandary, and you have it, I have it, labor has it. What do you do? You know that the alternative is worse than Obama. No question about that. To me, it would be catastrophic for this country if we had a Republican president and an entirely Republican Congress. Absolutely. However, we also know that Obama has been weak on a lot of areas that are near and dear to our heart. What do you do to impress him and tell him, look, Mr. President, you need to get more emphatic. You need to have a jobs program. You need to tell the American people what you want, and this is what you're going to do, a clear message. You have left us down. Now, how far do you go with that, Rick? Do you threaten to take away your support? Do you meet behind the scenes if we'll meet with you? What exactly do you do?
Did 2010 not wake anybody up? I mean, did no one on the Democratic side of the aisle read the tea leaves after 2010? Do they not realize that being this centrist, middle-of-the-road, wishy-washy, spineless creature cost them?
Well,
had they been true leaders and said, this is our vision, this is our direct, like the Republicans are doing here, like the Republicans did in Wisconsin, we may not agree with them. But they stood up, they said, we're going to ram our agenda through, and if you don't like it, try and stop us.
Well, some in this administration apparently haven't got the message, because there was a clear message that the Obama administration and President Obama was moving to the center. And you know it, and I know it, and he did that in the last 6 months. You and I have problems with some of his close advisors, and therein lies one of the major, major differences that we have with the administration. He, in fact, is too close to Wall Street. No question about it.
What you should have done from the beginning, and again, you know, it's too late now, but they should have led. And, you know, I agree with some of the Republicans. He doesn't have a plan. He hasn't come out and said, this is my vision. Now, could that be that he's a constitutional scholar and he understands how government works and that it's the Congress's job to do a lot of this stuff? Maybe that's his fault. I don't know. But at the end of the day, the image, and maybe campaign Obama, who came out today, you know, they started their bus trip in Minnesota. Maybe campaign Obama will start to get it. Maybe the more he does the speeches and the more he interacts with regular we the rabble, maybe he'll start to get it. I don't know. But pushing free trade agreements in places like Minnesota, pushing free trade agreements, places like Michigan, pushing free trade agreements in Ohio and Pennsylvania, that is going to be one sure way to get him to be the Jimmy Carter that the Republicans want him to be.
And he actually mentioned free trade in Michigan last week, and according to the commentators, there was, you know, nobody booed him. They weren't disrespectful. But
it was crickets.
Yes, exactly. And he did come out, to be fair. He came out with a few proposals today, which makes sense. It's a good beginning, but he's got a long way to go.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Ian Millhiser from American Progress Action Fund. We're right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The Communications Workers of America and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers have filed unfair labor practice charges against Verizon, charging that the company has refused to bargain in good faith. The unions want the NLRB to immediately order Verizon to negotiate in good faith as labor law requires. Some 45,000 CWA and IBEW Verizon workers have been on strike since August 7th. The highly profitable Verizon is demanding $1 billion in concessions, $20,000 per working family there. Verizon has gotten court injunctions in several states that limit picketing. Bill Huber is business manager of IBEW Local 827, one of the striking locals at Verizon.
It's clear to myself and the other leaders of the unions that what Verizon is attempting to do is just break the unions.
Huber says Verizon is not merely asking for a bigger contribution to health care costs. It's gutting 50 years of collective bargaining gains. And he says the American public should rally to the strikers' cause. Why? Because it's a battle in defense of the American middle class.
They're not interested in bargaining with us. They're not interested in compromise. They're interested in gutting. We're just on a path to destroy middle America. We need the public to reach out to their politicians and stop greedy companies like Verizon that make significant money here. Stop them from breaking the back of the middle class America. Because if they win, if they're successful at this, the United States, we're down the tubes. Because everybody else is going to follow this pattern.
The U.S. Postal Service is urging Congress to gut collective bargaining rights for postal workers so 120,000 workers can be laid off. The Postal Service cites a huge $8 billion deficit as the motive for its attack on workers, but a congressional mandate enacted in the Bush administration forces the Postal Service to pre-fund 75 years' worth of retiree health benefits. That mandate alone costs $5.5 billion a year, and it's imposed only on the Postal Service. Lifting that mandate, or allowing pension surpluses to be applied to those retiree health benefits, would wipe out the deficit and avoid the massive layoffs. Sally Davidow is a spokesperson for the American Postal Workers Union. She says this big lie that the postal deficit is a result of union workers is an effort to use the cover of a crisis for hostile action against workers, with privatization of the postal service the possible ultimate goal.
Certainly for some of these ultra-right-wing congressmen, I do think that is the goal. Clearly an attempt to take a crisis and try and use it to advance an ideological agenda that's hostile to workers. The same law that implemented the pre-funding requirement said the Postal Service could not raise prices over the rate of inflation. If you say they can't raise prices and then you give them a $5.5 billion bill every single year for 10 years, what's the effect going to be? It's going to destroy the Postal Service.
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company, and by OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a great state. We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
They're selling make-believe and we don't buy that here. Cause in the real world they're shutting Detroit down.
Well, you know, they have their way here in Pennsylvania. Our governor, who seems to idolize Texas, we're going to be just like them. All those minimum wage jobs, no protection for workers. Yeah, that seems to be the Republican thought process here. Real quick, the Borowitz report for yesterday really kind of made me laugh a little bit. He writes, calling the results of Saturday's Iowa straw poll alarming. Standards & Poor took the unprecedented action of downgrading Iowa's IQ. While the effects of such an extraordinary measure are hard to predict, experts say the IQ downgrade could result in Iowans having difficulty completing sentences or operating a television remote. An S&P spokesperson said this downgrade would be very upsetting to Republicans in Iowa. Fortunately, there's no way they'll understand it. The winner in the straw poll, Representative Michelle Bachmann, gave a rousing victory speech that was simulcast in English across the state. But there may be tough sledding ahead for Representative Bachmann. A new poll shows her losing support to Texas Governor Rick Perry among voters who describe themselves as morons. Governor Perry kicked off his presidential campaign on Saturday in South Carolina, unveiling a new stump speech in which he promised to repeal the entire 20th century. Basically what I've been saying all along. But here to talk to us a little bit about Rick Perry on a serious note is our good friend Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress Action Fund, where he's a policy analyst and blogger. Ian, thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be back. Thanks, Ray.
You know, I'm looking at this guy, and I've taken the, and let's see if you get the reference. I've been calling him Damien Thorne, because I see him as the Antichrist. This guy scares me to death.
This is a whole new era for presidential politics. You know, I've always secretly suspected that there's a lot of right-wingers who want to, as you put it, repeal the whole 20th century. But this guy, you know, he is out of the closet. You know, he's calling Medicare and Social Security unconstitutional. He's calling all environmental laws unconstitutional. Education, you know, if you want a Pell Grant, if you want a federal student loan, unconstitutional. I mean, this is insane. This is the most maximalist conservatism I've ever heard coming out of someone's mouth. And he's, you know, the one thing I'll give him credit for is at least he is being open. At least he is being truthful about the wacky, wacky things that he believes.
Yeah, and, you know, in looking at, you know, in some of the things, I know a lot of people who claim to be constitutional scholars, even though they never got out of the third grade. But here, this guy scares me. Medicare, Social Security claims are unconstitutional. Environmental laws, unconstitutional. I'm surprised child labor and all that other stuff isn't unconstitutional, according to him.
You know, that's the one thing he hasn't said, is he hasn't gone all in for child labor. But if you look at the theories that he's espousing, you know, the same part of the Constitution, the same means of interpretation that says Congress can regulate commerce, and that means they can regulate smokestacks, you know, is the same theory that says Congress can regulate commerce, and that means that they can regulate our workplace. You know, if you say that you can't have environmental laws, that means you also can't have basic labor laws, because it's the same part of the Constitution that allows both. And that means no child labor laws, that means no minimum wage, that means no overtime, none of that. This is terrifying, this ideology that he's espousing.
And what's even more terrifying is that I do believe the next president is going to appoint one, at least one, but probably two or three Supreme Court justices who may espouse the same kind of bizarre views that he has.
That's right. I mean, this is a really pivotal moment for the Supreme Court. Justice Ginsburg, who is one of the four more moderate members of the Supreme Court, is 78, and she's a cancer survivor. So, you know, if she has to step down, that would mean that instead of having four really conservative justices and Justice Kennedy, who's still pretty conservative, but there's a real difference between him and Scalia. You know, if Justice Ginsburg has to step down, that means we have five dyed-in-the-wool, hard-nosed conservatives, never compromising on anything. You know, at the same time, Scalia and Kennedy are both in their 70s. If one of them steps down and they're replaced by someone more like Justice Ginsburg, it's a whole new world for the country, because then we're going to have five moderate justices, something we haven't had for many decades. It's a completely different Supreme Court.
And especially when you look at the fact that just on Friday, the 11th Circuit, I believe it was, shot down, you know, called the health care reform bill unconstitutional. We know it's going to the Supreme Court. We just don't know when. This could play out in a couple of years being that kind of scenario where this gets before a Supreme Court that maybe we have the chance to, if Kennedy steps down or something happens, turn that around.
No, that's right. I mean, I'm reasonably confident with this Supreme Court that the 11th Circuit's going to get reversed. But if we have one or two justices fall, you know, we could have not just the health reform bill struck down, but you could start to see your basic labor protections go away like that. You could start to see, even if they're not striking down laws, we've already seen what they've done with forced arbitration, what they've done with class actions, where they say, oh, yeah, you're supposed to have a right here. We're just not going to let you get to that right. We're not going to let you get to court. We're not going to let you enforce your right. So they can ramp that up and leave people with nothing. Even if Congress passes a law to protect you, if the Supreme Court falls, you don't have any way to access that right, so you're left with nothing.
Yeah, it's definitely scary times on the Supreme Court. You know, and going back to Governor Perry, though, with these bizarre views he has on the Constitution, basically, you know, there's nothing that he sees as constitutional. He seemed to have no problem in issuing this executive order mandating that all girls get this HPV vaccine that even he himself admits he didn't research and he didn't understand.
Yeah. Although, you know, there I will come to his defense on his first position. So HPV is, you know, just like people need to get vaccinated for things like measles, mumps, and rubella before they can go to school. HPV is, you know, something that we have a reliable vaccine for. And I'm more mad at him there because he initially did the right thing. And then when the Christian right and when other people got up in arms, then he backed away right away. And now he doesn't want to touch one of the few good things that he's ever done. So that's actually one thing where I would have given him credit, except for the fact that he didn't have the courage of his convictions on it.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that for me it is, though, that he doesn't believe a lot of things are constitutional, yet he can then take this, something he doesn't understand, and we can
right.
debate the whole whether HPV is good or bad or indifferent. It's the fact that he didn't understand it. He didn't do any research, but he saw no problem when it comes to, and this is my whole view of the Christian movement in this country, that anything that has to do with women or girls, they're always secondary citizens.
You know, it's really, I mean, it's quite striking, just how ill-informed he is and how he's willing to act on his lack of information. You know, if you just read the Constitution, it says very clearly, Congress can tax you and it can provide for your general welfare. There's your Social Security, there's your Medicare, there's your education benefit, there's all of that. It says that our commerce can be regulated so we can have environmental laws, we can have safe workplaces, we can have people who can earn a decent wage and they don't have to work 12, 13, 14, 15 hours a day and they can join unions. You know, if you just read the document, all of this is pretty clear, and it's very clear that he's acting on the basis of very little information, you know, if any at all.
Yeah. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Ian Millhiser, policy analyst and blogger at the American Progress Action Fund. Ian, you know, I look at this, and you know, I can't keep going back to what harm could a governor from Texas do? I think about, you know, Bush, who used to love going around saying, well, I was a C student. Some of the information that I've seen, he was actually a D student in economics.
You know, he got a D in economics. He got an F in, like, some, like, animal something or another course. I mean, he does not have an impressive transcript. But I'm more concerned with the F he's getting in governance right now. You know, Texas, and he likes to talk about how he's had some sort of miraculous job center in Texas. Texas is a terrible place to live. It's got the highest percentage of minimum wage jobs in the country, the worst health insurance rate in the country, and despite the fact that they have a ton of oil money because gas prices are spiking, and so they have a ton of this oil money coming in, bolstering their economy, their unemployment rate is still, they're still only 24th in the country. That's worse than New York, worse than Massachusetts, worse than, you know, almost half the states. So he can't even maintain a decent country, a decent state, when he's getting this influx of oil money because all of us are shipping our dollars off to Texas because we got to pay $4 a gallon at the pump.
Right. It's interesting you brought up that it's a different country. Because there at one point, if I got this right, he actually advocated seceding from the union.
You know, it was quite a Freudian slip on my part. No, that's right. I mean, he actually said that, you know, if the federal government doesn't start doing things his way, then Texas may need to secede, which is crazy talk. You know, I mean, besides the fact that it is unconstitutional for Texas to secede, I wonder at the attitude of someone who believes that he would do a good job as the leader of the United States of America when he's not even willing to accept the Lincolnian principle that we are the United States of America and we should stick together.
Yeah, I look at this and I go, well, if you're willing to, you know, do the kind of almost the Sarah Palin thing, I'm going to take my ball and go home. What are you going to do if you're the top guy here?
Yeah, I guess the one advantage is that the United States can't secede from the United States. But yeah, it's just bizarre. I mean, he mouths off, and he mouths off in ways that reveal that he's not just ill-informed, but it makes you wonder, you know, if he can speak off the cuff, what sort of actions is he going to take off the cuff?
Yeah, I look at the big response that he had, and I got to be honest, I'm uncomfortable with the whole the whole marrying up. And I do believe that if he wins, this, we will become a theocracy. And we, the fear is that we become Iran, only a Christian version of that. One of my listeners sent me an American flag, the Rick Perry flag, that instead of the stars, you know, being in the pattern that they're in, the stars are actually in the sign of a cross.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are a lot of things about his record that are deeply concerning. He had the prayer rally recently. But, I mean, when I look at his record, the thing that I view as the clear and present danger, if his agenda were to be implemented, is this dismantling of all the progress of the 20th century. I mean, it is bad enough to have to worry about the wall of separation between church and state down. But, you know, if our grandparents can't count on their Medicare benefits, if our workers can't work in safe environments, if we can't trust the air that we breathe, what do we have? You know, and that's the vision that he has been, you know, to his credit, very honest about, that he wants to implement.
Yeah. I told one of my listeners, I'm going to probably, because one of my listeners believes that the end of the world is coming in 2012. And I said, if he becomes president, maybe, you know, maybe that the whole Omen thing, maybe he is Damien Thorne. Maybe that's the direction we're going to go.
We have interesting times ahead, there's no doubt.
Well, like they say, may you live in interesting times. Ian Milheiser, you do great work over there. Thanks. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rick.
Ian Milheiser, policy analyst and blogger at the American Progress Action Fund. We're going to take a quick break right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I'm often asked, do Republicans serve any real purpose in Congress? Yes, they do. They proudly serve as the plodding pack mules of corporate America, dutifully hauling any load that a corporation piles on their backs, no matter how odious. Take Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, whose back is permanently swayed from 34 years of carrying corporate legislation. Most recently, he's been toting a stinky load for Delta and other airlines that want Congress to rig their employees' unionization elections by decreeing that those who choose not to vote be counted as having voted against unionization. To get what his corporate drivers wanted, the mulish Hatch went to extremes this summer. He held the Federal Aviation Administration's budget hostage for nearly 2 weeks, forcing this essential public safety agency to lay off 4,000 employees and halt an array of airport improvement projects across the country, idling tens of thousands of construction workers. Braying and kicking, the senator from Delta was perfectly willing for this destructive shutdown to continue through August, even as he and other lawmakers went on vacation. But less obstinate Republicans intervened with a patchwork deal that lets the FAA operate until mid-September. After that, who knows? But what about airline safety, you ask? Hatch showed that he didn't care, but luckily for us, key agency workers did. Dozens of FAA safety inspectors volunteered to stay on duty during Hatch's shutdown, even though they were not being paid and were even having to use their personal credit cards to cover their on-the-job travel expenses. If only senators had such a sense of responsibility. This is Jim Hightower saying, remember, these public-spirited employees are some of the same government workers who are denigrated as slugs and leeches by the Orrin Hatches of our country.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. So it looks like deja vu all over again. It looks like it's 1981 all over again. The day Reagan came into office, the day he decided, tear those sissy pansy solar panels off of my White House and bring me back in good old-fashioned oil. And that's what they did. They went in, they tore the solar panels off the White House that Carter had put in. And they ended up, you know, on some college up north, which are still in use today. He heats all the hot water for the college cafeteria, doing a very nice job here. 40 years later, still doing the job. Well, the Corbett administration, according to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, they are de-emphasizing renewable energy and energy conservation, eliminating programs created by previous Democratic and Republican administrations as it focuses on, guess what? That's right, natural gas. They've been bought, they've been paid for, the funds have come in, the campaign donations are there, the coffers are full. So it's payback time. So move away from all the things that we've been trying to do to get off the juice and put all of our attention then into what has been bought and paid for. The article says, quietly but systematically, the administration has all but shut down the State Department of Environmental Protection's Office of Energy and Technology Deployment. That's the state's primary energy office. And removed directors and reassigned staff of the Office of Energy Management in the Department of General Services and the Governor's Green Government Council. So goodbye to that. It has also forbidden state executive agencies from signing contracts that support clean energy supply. And again, you know, this is part of the new approach. This is the new direction. We're deja vu all over again, going backward. They want to develop the Marcellus Shale gas policy. What they're saying now, and Jan Jarrett, the person over at Penn Future, saying, look, you're putting at risk more than 100,000 green jobs. She says, quote, in the past 12 years, Pennsylvania has gone from having virtually no clean energy jobs to employing more than 106,000 Pennsylvanians in the clean energy industry, despite the national recession. She goes on to say these program cuts and legislative attacks threaten to kill those good family-sustaining jobs. And you look down the line, you know, and there are Republicans who are saying, you know, we don't want this to go either. But at the end of the day, what's going to happen is the exact same thing that happened under Reagan. They got a new idea, and all of the other resources that we've put into developing this industry are going to go by the wayside. And what I find interesting, again, you know, as a nation, we put a little bit of money in. Not a lot, a little bit. We put a little bit of money into this, and it's dying now. Because we've got governors, you know, not only here, but across the country. You know, Colorado, Florida, Iowa, Kansas, Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, you name it, Ohio, Wisconsin. You know, all of these states are going, well, you know, we're maybe starting to look at something different. You know, we're going to go away from solar, maybe because, you know, we just don't have the money. We're going to pull back. Well, what that means is you're going to see that industry collapse because it's still not there yet, which is why I bring up this next story. Evidently, Evergreen Solar, a U.S. solar company, has filed for bankruptcy today. They were a cutting-edge manufacturer. They were right there. Understand, the solar panels are something that we developed in this country. And the rest of the world basically eating our lunch because we've allowed it. And they're filing bankruptcy because we can't compete with the Chinese. And the fact is that you've got states that are pulling back. You've got Europe that's pulling back on its subsidies. So you're looking at this company who, you know, created jobs, now going away. They're in big trouble. And it comes back down to, for me, what direction is our energy policy in this country going to go to? There's so much opportunity. But we're hell-bent on burning things, Jake. We're hell-bent on, hey, let's stop what's working and let's go back to where we can profit. Because the problem is they haven't figured out how to really profit from solar.
And a couple years ago, that was our one bright hope, that and wind. And that was one thing, you know, a lot of us, you know, the average citizen thought, well, the wind is free, the sun is free. We should be able to take advantage of it. And there were some companies out there that a couple years ago looked like they're going to have a bright future. But going back to the governor, I mean, you got to give him credit. I mean, the natural gas industry got a big bang for that $1 million, didn't he? Wow. I mean, and he's not. I read a comment by his administration, and they're trying to kind of cover up. And
he's not shy about it.
They're trying to give their side of the story, but at the end, it's pretty clear what they want to do.
And again, you know, I go, okay, so we're gonna start looking at natural gas. Are we not capable of doing both? You know, there's so much opportunity, but it comes down to who's going to profit. And I look at this, and again, I'm thinking this is going to be the death of solar in the U.S. as we see states and we see the federal government walking away from it. And these industries will collapse. And the Chinese, they will be the ones who are the recipient of all of this technology and all of this manufacturing capability. And they're going to be the ones who, you know, are the leaders. So it's interesting time. It's scary times, but it's also predictable times.
You said will be. The Chinese, look what they've done with wind power. Again, there was another very, very promising industry. We did create some jobs here. And what has happened in some of the big projects in the last year? They're made in China. Unbelievably, they're made in China. Some of those projects actually had public money.
Well, you look at the one in Texas, the really big one.
Yeah, that was the one I was thinking of.
The really big one that they built. You know, and in fact, the Chinese were smart. They said, we want our workers to go install them. You know, we want to bring our people into this. So not only are they importing the knowledge to put it up. And what frightens me, and we've talked about this, about the end of manufacturing in this country, you're having a massive brain drain of people who know how to build things, who know how to tinker. And I go back to, you know, being home in Cleveland. You know, I saw all of those factories, all of those little shops. They were little machine shops all over the place. And they're all closed. They're all boarded up. Mm-hmm. And it's not there anymore. And that's because the big centers of the auto industry are gone. All those little shops fed into that. And all of those little machine shops and little stamping plants, gone. And those places used to employ 20, 30, 50 people. And they were good, solid jobs. Really, they were filled with people who had the ability to make things. These were people who understood how to create something out of a raw piece of material. And what I'm really worried about is that we're going to lose that intellectual, that human capital that allows you to take a piece of raw steel and turn it into a car. For example, it'll take you to cut down a tree and build furniture or houses or whatever. We're losing that. And, you know, I remember the kid that called not too long ago said, well, we could be a service-based economy. You know, all we need to do is be more service-based. And I go, well, you know, at what point do we benefit from that? You know, what value are you adding to the things? I'll cut your grass, you cut my hair. You know, that's no way to run an economy. You know, I'll wash your dog, you wash my car. You know, I'll make you breakfast, you make me dinner. What wealth have you created? You're trading services. And maybe a barter economy like that's not a bad idea. But for 310 million people, it's impossible. You know, in my neighborhood, maybe the five or six people I deal with, maybe that's okay there. But for 310 million people, not happening. We need manufacturing back. We need to start building things. You know, I had a long discussion with a relative this weekend. And, you know, oddly enough, we actually agreed that, you know, just building roads and bridges isn't going to be enough. You know, rebuilding our infrastructure isn't enough if we're importing all of the materials. If all of the concrete is coming from China or overseas, all the steel's coming from overseas, it's not going to help us any because you haven't created anything. You haven't added any value to anything. All you've done is another service. And yes, construction is another service, but it's, taking that, which was raw material, and turning it into something, but we're not making that raw material here anymore.
And that's why when we build the road system, it was such a stimulus in the economy because all the products, all the service, country.
I mean, many of those are gone. I look at the roads back home in Cleveland and pretty much the whole way here, and I go, Mike, there's so much work that needs to be done. And I was driving around downtown Cleveland going, man, there's just so much that needs to be done, much like here. I mean, you could drive around areas, part of the central Pennsylvania area and go, you know, there are places that need tons of work. And it's a shame that we've got people unemployed because there's the ability to put them back to work today and to teach them a skill and to get them employed. And just so many opportunities, and we're just withering them away. Why? Because we need to have a wealth class full of people who need to fill their pockets. That's what's frustrating to me, that we're wasting this opportunity. And tomorrow you've got these crazy people, these Republicans who want to push this no rights at work agenda tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And I suggest if you've got time, come down or get here early because they're only going to let so many people into the main hearing room and then they've got an overflow room. But I would love to see, you know, 40 supporters of union rights sitting in that hearing room. But they're going to do Mad Cows. They're having a hearing on Mad Cows, no rights at work agenda, 1 to 4 p.m. We're going to talk about that in the next segment with Professor Paul Clark, but also tomorrow night we'll cover what happened during the testimony. You know what's going to happen. You're going to hear people, you know, with all this blathering going on, and we're saying, oh, how the union harmed me. Not that it rose wages and created a middle class, but it harmed me. Pitiful. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, Professor Paul Clark, Penn State University, back after this.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My cases are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse, because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to .com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got our rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
It is for this reason that I must tell those who fail to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law. And if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, that, to me, that was the beginning of all of this. That was the beginning of the assault on workers' rights, the beginning of the attacks on labor, the beginning of the attack, really what I've been calling the shot heard across the boardroom. the beginning of the latest edition of the class war. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock from 1 to 4 here in the Capitol, they're going to be another battle. Going to be hearing the Mad Cow Amendment bills, House Bill 50, 51, 52, and 53, what I'm calling the No Rights at Work agenda. But, you know, they make it sound so good, and tomorrow I'm sure they will have their performance in line. That's why I've asked Professor Paul Clark from Penn State University. He's the head of the Department of Labor Studies and Employment Relations to come talk to us a little bit about what exactly this right-to-work stuff is. Professor Clark, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure. Good evening, Rick.
You know, tomorrow the No Rights at Work agenda is going to be heard. This idea that, and it sounds so good, you have the right to work, but do you really have the right to work?
Well, yeah, the right to work movement has always really been about weakening the American labor movement. Yeah, they've been pretty clever in coining the term right to work, but that really has very little, if anything at all, to do with what the right to work movement is about. The right to work movement is basically about weakening the labor by creating division, by reducing the resources the labor movement has to operate with. It's a pretty transparent movement.
Well, and they've been pretty honest about it. You look at what happened in Wisconsin, and they came right out and said, we're going to, you know, we're basically gutting our enemies. We're gutting the Democrats and their main money source.
All right. You know, it might be useful for your readers for your listeners, Rick, to really understand the legal issue here in terms of right to work. When the National Labor Relations Act was passed, it gave workers the chance to vote for a union if a majority of workers voting in the election chose to bring in a union. But the law also said that if a union won a representation election, it now had the responsibility to represent all workers in that workplace. So, for instance, if there's 100 workers and the vote's 51 to 49 for the union now has the duty to bargain for not just the 51 who voted for the union, but all 100.
Right.
And what the law said is if the unions now have that responsibility, then the 49 who didn't vote for the union have to accept majority rule. And if the union negotiates a union security clause, they have to contribute to the upkeep of the union, to the union's ability to represent those people.
Right.
That's a fundamentally kind of democratic principle. You know, the analogy I use is that citizens of the United States, if one party or the other wins the election, wins the presidency, for instance, they can't go off and secede from the country. They can't shirk their responsibility. They can't say, I'm not going to pay taxes because I didn't vote for that government. And they're not forced to pay the taxes, in essence. People can leave the country if they feel that strongly. That's the way it is in the workplace. People are not forced to join a union. But if they're going to work in a workplace and enjoy the representation of the union, then they have to pay their fair share to the maintenance of that union. That's what right to work or that's what the union security clauses that right-to-work laws try to do with, away with are all about.
Right. And you know, the whole idea, though, is if you listen to the people who advocate for this no rights at work agenda that they euphemistically call the right to work, that's what they're advocating. Why should I have to pay for it? Why should I have to support something? And the people who are espousing this most of the time are the exact people who then would run government, without dealing with people like me who may not agree with them. It's very much an ideological center for them.
Well, it absolutely is. And what's a little bit, I guess really frustrating about the right to work movement is this sort of feigned concern for workers. They're so concerned about workers' rights in the workplace that they shouldn't have to belong to a union that they don't, that they didn't vote for. They never seem to have any concerns about the
Yep, he's gone. But yeah, the reality is, and he's right. I mean, they never really seem to have all that much concern for the workers that work for them. It's just so pathetic and transparent. And I kind of laugh at it, you know, like with Verizon saying, oh, well, you know, we want our employees to be like the other ones. Yes, making less money. You know, we want them to work for their customers. They do. It's really very strange. And I often, the question that I want to ask Paul Clark is, you know, what would Pennsylvania look like if we became the 23rd right to work state? Professor Clark, thanks for calling back.
Yeah. You ask about, the impact of right to work or what do right to work states look like? I once did a little study, looking at things like, the amount of money spent, on education per citizen in right-to-work states, the average income in right-to-work states, the number of people living below the poverty line in right-to-work states. And in all those instances, right-to-work states spent less on education. They had lower per capita income in virtually every state. And that's no accident. It's because the labor movements there have been weakened by right-to-work laws. And workers have a tough time organizing and, bargaining decent wages and having a prosperous economy. That would be the impact of right-to-work laws in Pennsylvania. But, right-to-work, the Pennsylvania Right-to-Work Committee has introduced a bill to pass a right-to-work law in the Pennsylvania legislature every year for, 30 or 40 years.
Right.
It never gets anywhere. And I think we need to be concerned about it, but I think the bigger concern is in the public sector. One of the bills you mentioned would do away with the agency shop for unions in the public sector. And given what's happened in Wisconsin and Indiana and Tennessee and some other states, that's probably an area where there should be some concern. Perhaps that movement that's been started by Governor Walker out in Wisconsin might gain some traction here. And if that was the case, that would greatly weaken public sector unions in Pennsylvania, and we'd see them become weaker and weaker, and we'd see consequent loss in bargaining power, loss in salaries and wages that those unions could bargain.
Yeah, in looking at that, and I think you're spot on there, considering how well these petty dictators who are CEOs have destroyed unions in the private sector by doing really illegal things. I mean, you look at some of the reports that I've seen. Most organizing campaigns have some really horrendous things that could go on, and our laws are so fractured and broken that it's incapable of keeping up with it.
Yeah, it's a right that American workers have to choose a union, but it's a right in which you are putting yourself at great risk by exercising. There aren't that many rights that we have on the books in this country that are as dangerous to your personal and welfare and your personal financial situation as exercising the right to join a union. It would be really nice to see people who are so concerned about workers' rights. Allegedly, the right-to-work people are very concerned about workers' rights, but they only seem to be about rights that benefit corporations, the right of workers not to choose a union. And, I think it's pretty transparent, as I said before, a transparent movement.
Right. And, the thing is you brought up that it's a dangerous proposition. Not as dangerous as our new, soon to be new trading partners in Colombia, where they take them up in planes and throw them out of the plane or pull them off of buses and shoot them in the head, but still dangerous nonetheless.
Yeah. I used to follow and monitor the Right to Work Committee, the National Right to Work Committee, pretty closely in the 80s and the 90s. And I can tell you with all honesty that, the impact they have on workers' lives, the impact that their movement has, really, it only has a negative impact. And it's pretty clear there was an effort many, many years ago to try to reveal who was funding the National Right to Work Committee. And there was some effort in court to take them to court and find out where their funds came from. They were able to fight that off in the courts. And I think the reason they fought so viciously is, although they like to portray themselves as standing up for the worker, there's absolutely no question that the vast majority of their funding comes from business people, large corporation, business people, and it's really kind of just one of these front groups really should just be, you know, an arm of the Chamber of Commerce or of multinational corporations, because it has no concern for the day-to-day rights of workers.
Or for the middle class or for the working people. If you look at the states that have the higher poverty numbers, and you talked to this a minute ago, states like Texas, who have the highest number of minimum wage jobs, one of the highest numbers of childhood poverty, one of the highest uninsured rates, yet we've got a governor here who says we want to be like Texas.
Yeah, we want to be like Texas, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Arkansas, Louisiana. I mean, these are the right-to-work states, and they have the lowest per capita incomes in the country. They have the worst educational systems in the country. People don't have access to health care in the way they do in other states. The whole principle, or one of the key contributions that the American labor movement has made in the last 80 years is bringing the standards of living of average Americans up. The American labor movement built the middle class in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And the corporate and conservative movements in this country have spent the last 20 to 30 years dismantling that middle class.
Yep.
And they have all kinds of tools and weapons. They have sophisticated union busters, anti-union attorneys who come in and manipulate the legal process. They put tons of money into politics to weaken workers' rights. And this National Right to Work movement is just one small kind of arrow in their quiver that is just another way to peck away at the rights of workers and the middle class that the unions they've built, has built in this country.
As I've been saying, they're just one more tool to redistribute wealth from people who make it to people who sit on their yachts and collect it.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy. A tool is a pretty good description.
But tomorrow, the big thing, 1-4 here in Harrisburg. I'm hoping folks will come out. Professor Clark, I appreciate the information. Thanks for the conversation. I look forward to having you back again real soon.
Sure. Keep up the good work, Rick.
Thank you, sir. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member made it. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous. The salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make people happy!
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
I drive by the homeless sleeping on a cold dark street, like bodies in an old bone grave. Underneath the broken old neon sign, used to read Jesus sings.
That's what I thought Obama was. You know, you listen to the words to that. You know, you drive by the homeless sleeping on a cold, dark street, you know, laying there like in open graves. You know, a mile away live the rich folks. You know, see how they're living it up while the poor eat from hand to mouth, the rich drinking from the golden cup. You know, it makes you wonder. And like he says, why do so many lose and only a few win? I mean, you want to talk about a class war song? There it is right there, folks. And you look at the reality is we are living in that world where the handfuls are the ones who decide what happens to the masses. You know, this is our country, yet good luck seeing that play out in Washington, where the big money has decided. Frustrating, frustrating stuff. Our quote of the day comes from Michelle Bachmann. I love Michelle Bachmann. She was speaking to a congregation of the Living Word Christian Center back in 2006. She said, "The Lord says, be submissive, wives. You are to be submissive to your husband." And we are hearing this ever louder and louder. I got to tell you, I'm scared to death that this mentality is going to play out. More and more, this, you know, I've been talking about it for about 6 years now. You know, since we've been on air, this whole idea that women need to be subservient, that they need to be submissive, that they're second-class citizens. And I've said before, and I've said it to, you know, anybody who'll listen, if it was just me, I don't know that I would mind it. It's kind of nice to have the thought that, you know, I could have some woman who would be cater to my every whim and be subservient and follow whatever I want. But, you know, I've got two daughters, and the thought of them playing a second fiddle, having to walk behind them or having to take second chair, just enrages me. And the more you're paying attention, and you know, she did it the other night. They asked her the question about that, she dodged it. But you know, Bachmann answered the question during the debate that she dodged. But you know, again, this whole idea, well, I went to law school to become a tax attorney because my husband said so. Really? Is that how things are going to work in your world? That scares me. But I was coming home from Cleveland, and there was this pastor on the radio, and it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. It was almost like it was a caricature. There was this black preacher. He was going, "God wants you to be happy. God wants you to be subservient, dear man." You know, and then he gets into this whole spiel about God loves Stephen. You know, it's almost Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving's around the corner, and God loves him some turkey. And he goes, "You know what I love best about turkey? I love the stuffing. I just love me some stuffing." He goes, not too thrilled about turkey. "If they could stuff fried chicken, I'd love it even better. Stuffing and fried chicken." And I'm sitting here and I'm going, "Well, wait a second. This sounds like, you know, like a joke. The guy sounds like, you know, it's like a caricature. He's just kind of making fun of." You know, I was waiting for the watermelon to come out. He goes, "God loves him some watermelon." But it wasn't. His whole spiel was that women need to to be subservient to their men. They need to change themselves. That, you know, it was the exterior beauty that got you. It got him. He saw the exterior. But God wants you to be like the stuffing. And it was really a very bizarre take, because I'm sitting there and I'm listening to this and I'm going, you know, I know some black women. Were there any in the audience? Because what he's saying is really the antithesis of what most of the black women I know would buy into, that they need to play second fiddle, that they need to be the ones who are subservient and submissive, and this whole kind of very right-wing religious kind of positioning that's going on in this country, where we're almost trying to indoctrinate young girls to be this mold. And while the guy was hysterical and made me laugh, he scared the hell out of me, because there's somebody listening to this guy, and he's making a boat ton of money while pushing this nonsense. And it, you know, again, I love his delivery. It's the Arsenio Hall in the movie Coming to America. It was just kind of a joke. But there he was preaching this, that somehow, he even went into the part that, you know, women marry men to change them. And, you know, you're not going to change them until you've got stuffing. And I'm going, I don't get that. But he does point out some interesting thing, though, which is most women do marry men to change them, which is kind of weird, because men marry women hoping they don't change. Kind of the weirdness of marriage. But, you know, I listen to this whole thing, and it's not just the black churches. It's all of these way out sects, and then it's the politics of, oh, we need to do away with Roe versus Wade, and then let's not stop there. Let's go after Griswold, and let's make sure that birth control is not there. And oh, hey, let's block this. Scary times, I'm telling you. I fear for my daughters that there are going to be guys out there who think that, you know what, you should be barefoot and pregnant, honey. What it is, though.
You know, you talk about that, and I think there's a lot of Americans that in general agree with you, Rick, and I think that could be the Achilles heel of the Texas governor, because there's a lot of that in him.
Yeah, because the good Pastor Evans, Mr. God wants you to have stuffing, he's actually from Dallas. And you look at this and you go, really? I mean, I love the delivery. I love that whole thing, but... This whole message of that, you know, you need to change yourself to please your man was really kind of bizarre to me.
We used to chuckle at a reverend when I was growing up by the name of Reverend Ike. You probably don't remember him. You're maybe a little bit too young, but he used to preach it. God wants you to be rich. He wants you to be rich. And you know, if you send a nice contribution to me, God will make sure that you get your share.
Well, that's all.
And we used to laugh at it. We used to laugh and have a chuckle, but, you know, there were some people that bought into it.
That's all those charlatans, though. It's all about the dollar. It's all about the bottom line. It's all about the show, you know. But at the end of it, you look at this, and what's destructive to me is, you know, I've always believed that you're equals. You know, in a marriage, you're equals. You know, I know the Bible says, well, man's the head of the household. I don't buy that. Sorry. You are partners in this. And one of the things when I got married is this idea that you are now one. So if you're actually, honestly, and truthfully one, when the two of you take your candles and light that one candle together, as most religious ceremonies do, you are now one. How can you possibly then separate that one and say one person is superior to the other? That's where their whole theology falls apart for me. If we're now one, we're one. We're equals. We're partners in this. No one has the say above the other. So what they're preaching is that if I make a decision and my wife disagrees, sorry, I'm superior to you because you should be submissive, and my decision is what matters. And that's kind of, isn't that spooky to you? I mean, because it's kind of spooky to me. It's kind of moving us backwards. But I think there's a sect in this country, and there's some women like this too, who long for days gone by that never were. The good old days weren't always that good. You know, I listen to the stories my grandmother told, you know, from, you know, 70 years ago. They weren't that great. Times were tough. Times were hard. Barefoot and pregnant wasn't all that great. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. We're right back after this.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Communications Workers of America and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers have filed unfair labor practice charges against Verizon, charging that the company has refused to bargain in good faith. The unions want the NLRB to immediately order Verizon to negotiate in good faith as labor law requires. Some 45,000 CWA and IBEW Verizon workers have been on strike since August 7th. The highly profitable Verizon is demanding $1 billion in concessions, $20,000 per working family there. Verizon has gotten court injunctions in several states that limit picketing. Bill Huber is business manager of IBEW Local 827, one of the striking locals at Verizon.
It's clear to myself and the other leaders of the unions that what Verizon is attempting to do is just break the unions.
Huber says Verizon is not merely asking for a bigger contribution to health care costs. It's gutting 50 years of collective bargaining gains. And he says the American public should rally to the strikers' cause. Why? Because it's a battle in defense of the American middle class.
They're not interested in bargaining with us. They're not interested in compromise. They're interested in gutting. We're just on a path to destroy middle America. We need the public to reach out to their politicians and stop greedy companies like Verizon that make significant money here. Stop them from breaking the back of the middle class America. Because if they win, if they're successful at this, the United States, we're down the tubes. Because everybody else is going to follow this pattern.
The U.S. Postal Service is urging Congress to gut collective bargaining rights for postal workers so 120,000 workers can be laid off. The Postal Service cites a huge $8 billion deficit as the motive for its attack on workers, but a congressional mandate enacted in the Bush administration forces the Postal Service to pre-fund 75 years' worth of retiree health benefits. That mandate alone costs $5.5 billion a year, and it's imposed only on the Postal Service. Lifting that mandate, or allowing pension surpluses to be applied to those retiree health benefits, would wipe out the deficit and avoid the massive layoffs. Sally Davidow is a spokesperson for the American Postal Workers Union. She says this big lie that the postal deficit is a result of union workers is an effort to use the cover of a crisis for hostile action against workers, with privatization of the Postal Service the possible ultimate goal.
Certainly for some of these ultra-right-wing congressmen, I do think that is the goal. Clearly an attempt to take a crisis and try and use it to advance an ideological agenda that's hostile to workers. The same law that implemented the pre-funding requirement said the Postal Service could not raise prices over the rate of inflation. If you say they can't raise prices and then you give them a $5.5 billion bill every single year for 10 years, what's the effect going to be? It's going to destroy the Postal Service.
This newscast made possible in part by Ulico, the Union Labor Life Insurance Company, and by OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Just when he thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Didn't take long at all for Rick Perry to, you know, start right in on the presidential gaffe machine, if you will. He was in Iowa, and he's talking about the Federal Reserve. And he comes out and he says, well, you know, I don't want to talk about it right now, pretty much saying that he doesn't know anything about it. But then he goes into this weird, and the audio may not be great, but he goes into this weird, this little weird talk.
I don't know what y'all would do to him in Iowa, but we would treat him pretty ugly down in Texas. I mean, printing more money to play politics at this particular time in American history is almost treacherous, or treasonous.
Almost treacherous. It's almost treacherous. Look, He's got to come up with something. I really don't think he understands what the Federal Reserve does or even is. Or he probably couldn't find it on a map. So he's got to say something that a talking point that'll give him some credit. And that's what it was. It was, you know, they're treacherous. I mean treasonous. And we'd be pretty ugly to them down in Texas. Actually, if you stop and think about it, they did bail out the economy. They did kind of, since when the Republicans refused to act, they did something to help create jobs. Now, I don't, you may not agree with the QE2, but at the end of the day, it still interjected some money into the economy to help get things going a little bit. I think we should have been doing more from the beginning with building, more from the beginning with investing, and less in the way of, here's a bunch of money, please go do something. But again, you know, this guy scares me. This guy is, you know, he came out earlier today and said, well, you know, even if we did raise taxes on millionaires and billionaires, not going to affect anything, not going to do anything. And you go, really? So if we raise taxes on Buffett and instead of $7 million, you tax him at about, you know, $50 million and him and all of his cronies along with it, that's not going to help? Would it make things worse? Well, according to them, it would make things worse. Interesting statistic coming out of the Boston College Sloan Center on Age and Work. A third of U.S. workers are seriously considering leaving their organization at the present time, up from 23% back in 2005, according to a 2011 report from Mercer. Among younger workers, 40% of employees 25 to 34 are seriously considering leaving, along with 44% of those age 24 and younger. At the same time, over half, 52% of U.S. employers are experiencing difficulty filling what they're calling mission-critical positions within their group, up from 14% just last year. And, you know, the reality is you treat people like garbage, and eventually they realize there's an amount of you-know-what they're not going to eat. And I was talking to my aunt this weekend, who I guess really having a problem at work. Some manager said something that she didn't like, something personal. She didn't like it. She asked him not to do it again. And he basically told, well, not basically, he told her to go F off. And now me, you would have told me to go F off. First I would have filed a grievance and we would have had a whole meeting and there would have been a whole powwow because, you know, I'm used to being able to do that. I would have told him to go F off himself, but she's a subordinate. And it kind of reinforced my belief that every worker needs a union because she's, you know, she told me, I don't understand. And she's right. I don't understand that level of powerlessness that she feels. I don't understand what it's like to have a supervisor who can tell you to go F off and you have no recourse whatsoever. And, you know, you go back to when, and she was telling me a story about when, you know, when she was raising my cousin who, you know, she was a single mother and raising this child and the boss knew it and, again, abused that situation. And my question has always been, why don't we see people like her? Why don't we see more single women flocking to labor? And I understand, look, you know, it's tough. It's tough to organize. But, you know, you look at the scenario like her. I mean, she's worked in an office all of her life, worked for horrible people. And that's the kind of treatment you have. And part of me says it's because we've been used to feeling powerless. Part of me says it's societal. It's part of what I've been calling the Stockholm syndrome. It's this whole attack on workers and this powerlessness that people like you, I don't think you understand it either, Jake. I know I don't. I don't understand how someone would just let their superior down the phone.
I mean, well, under those conditions, unfortunately, she has very few alternatives. She can try to get a union in there, or she can go to her supervisor, and in some organization. That doesn't end well, and so there are a few organizations that will do something if
there's no help here.
If the supervisor is that bad,
there's nothing. There's no help here, and at the end of the day, there's no help for people without having someone standing beside them. And, you know, that's what I was thinking about the whole way home last night. The more I kept thinking about that position, because my first reaction would have been tell him off, and then if he said it again, to knock him out. That would have just been my thought process. But that's different. You know, and I look at this. Why do people put up with it? And it's, again, she laid it out. You know, you got bills, and you've got mouths to feed, and they know it. And there's no recourse. And, you know, like she said, you know, they isolate people. They're masters at division. They're masters at keeping everyone apart. So there's no solidarity. There's no there's no interaction amongst employees. Which is why I'm hoping this program is part of that. The more you talk about how bad things can be. Now, look, there are some good employers. I know people who say, you know, I work for, you know, somebody, and they're great. And terrific. We need more of those. We need many more. But for the ones that aren't so great, we do need labor law reform. In this day and age, to still be talking about at-will employment as if, well, that's just how it is troublesome. And it's this whole attack machine, this whole right-wing attack machine on workers, this whole right-wing attack machine on the poor. You know, you go down the list. You know, there's been a war on women for years by the Republicans. You know, you look at the abortion thing. So if I get this right, and this is kind of what's got me kind of freaked out. So the Republican war machine, they can't overturn Roe versus Wade. Most of the time they can't get through with their anti-abortion laws. So then they come up with another idea, like in South Dakota. They were thinking about, stop thinking about this for a second. In South Dakota, they were thinking about passing a law that would make murdering an abortion doctor something that you could fight as self-defense in court. Now, when South Dakota dropped it, you know, Nebraska and Iowa kind of picked it up. It hasn't gone anywhere, but just the fact that they're talking about using a self-defense in a trial where you've in cold blood murdered an abortion doctor, to me, is scary. Absolutely scary. And, you know, the Republican war machine, instead of saying, okay, well, we can't criminalize abortions and throw women in jail who choose to have an abortion, instead of saying, so we'll choose to make having children more appealing, you know, help low-income women with a little security, help them want to bring children in the world because, you know, they're going to get fed and they're going to get health care and they're going to go to get education. Instead of doing that, they say, no, silly people. No. Let's make it even harder for poor women so that they actually do choose abortion. And you look at this war on welfare, this war on the WIC program, this war on feeding children in schools, all of this stuff that they think they're going to save money on. It seems kind of weird to me. And right down the list, the same people who advocate taking workers' rights away, taking women's rights away, are the same ones who want to keep us segregated, are the same people who want to keep us apart. And it's the reason that they're against the high-speed rail stuff. It's the reason they're against public transportation. They don't want people to be able to live in different neighborhoods. They want strict boundaries. They want to keep those people over there and those people over there. I mean, it's scary stuff. You know, they've got this war on net neutrality, for instance. We don't want people talking. We don't want people to have internet access. We want to be able to charge and have our own elite internet where we can do our own thing. I mean, does this seem nuts to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you touched on about a half dozen issues. You know, just to go back to the abortion issue, I mean, the logic that they're using in trying to pass a law is the same logic they used when these crazy people actually kill doctors. And their rationalization, Rick, is, well, I'm defending the life of the unborn child. And that's the same rationalization that they're going to try to use to get these bills passed. So let's get this straight. You're killing to defend life. Now, I don't know about you, but to me that never made a lot of sense. It just makes no sense. But that they actually believe that. And those who commit those murders actually believe that they are saints of God. And that is scary.
Because God wants you to have stuffing. God wants you to have fried chicken. And God wants women to be subservient to man. Because that's what God said. I love that guy. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Skies from Think Progress about this Rick Perry thing. Because it's, I got to be honest, amazing. Right back after this.
I announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
I'm often asked, do Republicans serve any real purpose in Congress? Yes, they do. They proudly serve as the plodding pack mules of corporate America, dutifully hauling any load that a corporation piles on their backs, no matter how odious. Take Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, whose back is permanently swayed from 34 years of carrying corporate legislation. Most recently, he's been toting a stinky load for Delta and other airlines that want Congress to rig their employees' unionization elections by decreeing that those who choose not to vote be counted as having voted against unionization. To get what his corporate drivers wanted, the mulish Hatch went to extremes this summer. He held the Federal Aviation Administration's budget hostage for nearly 2 weeks, forcing this essential public safety agency to lay off 4,000 employees and halt an array of airport improvement projects across the country, idling tens of thousands of construction workers. Braying and hicking, the senator from Delta was perfectly willing for this destructive shutdown to continue through August, even as he and other lawmakers went on vacation. But less obstinate Republicans intervened with a patchwork deal that lets the FAA operate until mid-September. After that, who knows? But what about airline safety, you ask? Hatch showed that he didn't care, but luckily for us, key agency workers did. Dozens of FAA safety inspectors volunteered to stay on duty during Hatch's shutdown, even though they were not being paid and were even having to use their personal credit cards to cover their on-the-job travel expenses. If only senators had such a sense of responsibility. This is Jim Hightower saying, remember, these public-spirited employees are some of the same government workers who are denigrated as slugs and leeches by the Orrin Hatches of our country.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Official supporter of Palin Santorum 2012. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, I've been saying it for the longest time. I do think he is Damien Thorne. I do think he is the Antichrist, and when he becomes president, I will buy into the end of the world is near. But here again, he's gotten himself. Welcome to the presidential nomination race, there, Rick Perry. Looks like you've stepped into a little bit of hot water, and I would expect it to be from no other guy than Scott Kies from Think Progress, who seems right now to be the Republican president killer. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rick.
So Herman Cain won't talk to you, Rick Santorum won't talk to you, Bachman won't talk to you.
I'll tell you who the most recent one who blacklisted me was, Tim Pawlenty. And we all know how that went.
That went well for him.
Exactly. No, you know, a lot of them just only really want to talk to people who they know are going to give them softball questions. And so anytime a report comes up with actual real policy questions, they, you know, get a little scared off by it. So, yeah, hopefully we'll be able to get some more questions into Rick Perry, but obviously only a couple days into his campaign now.
Well, how dare you think that they should have to answer an actual question?
No, yeah, and you know, the same thing happened to Mitt Romney. I was at the state fair, excuse me, on Thursday, walking along, and I believe, a reporter from NBC went up to him and asked him a question. He's like, I'm not taking questions right now. And she looked at him and said, but you're running for president. how are you not taking questions? You know, and just the absurdity that they can decide they, oh, I'm just not going to answer that. You know, I'm just going to avoid that issue.
Yeah,
it's ludicrous.
I love the spiel he gave when he was talking about when he finally came out with it. You know, corporations are people, my friend. That somebody in the audience screamed out, "You're supposed to be here to listen to us." And he goes, "No, I'm not."
it's ridiculous. You know, we had a good video up on Think Progress where we talked to state fairgoers, you know, at the Iowa State Fair, and just asked them point blank, do you think corporations are people? And, you know, the response was pretty predictable.
Yeah, I mean, the majority of people I know don't think corporations are people. And for all of my friends who want to, you know, they're hell-bent on amending the Constitution with, you know, gay marriage stuff or balanced budget stuff, I've got a really good one. Define a person as a human being that will die, with that bleeds, that has bones, that's as an actual human being, not a legal construct.
It says that corporations are people, so does that mean that he is endorsing marriage between one man and one corporation? You know, let's take this to its logical conclusion here.
You know, I got to be honest. I look at this, and at the end of the day, Rick Perry scares me.
Oh, yeah, no, and I'm sure you saw what happened tonight at the event that I was just at here in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where he was asked a question about the Fed and then ends up going on a tirade where he says, if this guy prints more money, I don't know what you all would do to him in Iowa. I'm quoting him here. I don't know what you all would do to him in Iowa, but we would treat him pretty ugly down in Texas. You know, that what he was doing was almost treasonous in his opinion. Now, you know, here he is not so subtly implying and threatening violence against the chairman of the Federal Reserve, who, by the way, was appointed by George W. Bush.
Yeah,
it's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, you know, how very presidential.
Right. And this guy wants to be president of the United States. And Ben Bernanke would still be chairman of the Fed Reserve when, you know, President Perry, in theory, would be coming into office.
Do you think is it that he didn't know exactly what, you know, what to say, and he just, you know, thought of a right-wing talking point and wanted to look tough? I mean, because a lot of what comes out of Texas, I think, you know, they've got this image that they have to uphold, and, you know, down in Texas, we take care of them.
Sure. You know, Ben Smith from Politico was speaking with him earlier today and asking him, you know, are you carrying a concealed weapon right now? And Perry just smiled and says, you know, I can't exactly tell you. It wouldn't be concealed, Ben. And, you know, concealed weapons are strictly forbidden and illegal at the Iowa State Fair. But here he is, you know, with his Texas swagger that the rules don't apply to him. I was noticing tonight, I was closing my eyes for a brief second, just how similar when you just close your eyes and think about it, and just listen how similar he sounds to the last Texan we had in the White House. And, you know, I'm thinking that's really actually going to be scaring a lot of people off who might otherwise be voting.
So I'm hoping, because, you know, at the end of the day, well, two things. One, there's part of me that hopes he wins so that I can use my Bush accent. And and two, the end of the world will then come, because I do think he is the Antichrist. But more importantly, we'll see what kind of what nation we are, because I've often said that once we finally describe ourselves as a Christian nation, we give up that whole separation of church and state thing. We just, you know, turn the stars on the flag into a cross, and we say, okay, we're a Christian nation. That's when the real fun is going to begin, when each of the sects then go after each other, and the Catholics and the Baptists and the evangelicals all go after each other. That's when the fun.
You know, I've actually started to encounter not an insignificant amount of angst against, for instance, Mitt Romney's Mormonism. A lot of folks saying, you know, well, he's not actually Christian, and I'm sure a lot of these same folks are similar to the ones we've been speaking to on the road. Who say, you know, well, Obama's not a Christian; he's a Muslim, don't you know?
Yep.
There's just a lot of people with really backwards views on what other folks believe, and then that's, you know, playing itself out in those bigoted views in the actual election in the ballot box.
Yeah, I mean, once we put aside the whole thing, there are no Muslims allowed in the U.S. Nobody but so-called Christians. You know, you look at the response people that he had, like John Hagee, Reverend Hagee, who basically hates Catholics.
Right. Oh, yeah.
That'll be fun to watch.
He's very upfront about it.
I mean, that'll be where the fun is because, you know, they're all well-armed.
Oh, sure. No, and, you know, Hagee, who was a speaker at Rick Perry's event just last weekend, John McCain had to reject John Hagee's endorsement because of his virulently anti-Catholic views.
Yep.
You know, like this is the 1960s when JFK is running for president.
Yeah, interesting times, especially when we're talking about another Texan. A guy, you know, like I said earlier with one of your colleagues, Ian Millhiser, you know, Bush ran. He said, I was a C president. this guy was a D student most of the time.
Yeah, no, it's like I said, Rick Perry's campaign is about 2 days old now, and this is the start that it's getting off to. I had been very worried about what his campaign, you know, that he's just the right blend of extremism to win the Republican nomination. But, man, with threatening violence against top government officials for doing their job,
yep.
I'd like to think that even – maybe even for the modern GOP, that would be a little bit too crazy. But
well, I think the Tea Party's going to be their new slogan.
They'll be rallying around violence towards Bernanke.
There you go, poor Bernanke. anyway, Scott, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for calling in and giving us an update on this. Keep up the good work, and you know, let's see who else you can get to ignore you.
Thanks, Rick. I'll let you know.
Thanks so much, Scott. I mean, the guy's brilliant. We need more people like this. He's the one who brought down Herman Cain's candidacy. Herman Cain won't even look at him. And none of the people will talk to him now because he asks a question. And how dare you ask me a question that I've actually got to answer? Anyway, you look at the straw poll there in Ames, Iowa this week, past weekend. Michelle Bachmann, obviously, on top. Then Ron Paul and Pawlenty finished third, and then he drops out. So I'm like, well, that's kind of weird. Santorum was quite happy finishing fourth. In fact, stayed an extra day, I guess. Herman Cain, also very happy to finish fifth. Saying, you know, we didn't spend a lot of money, but we did okay. Then Rick Perry, who didn't really participate. He finished sixth, Romney seventh, Gingrich eighth. Some guy named Others finished ninth. Then John Huntsman and Thaddeus McCotter, 11th. The Others guy gets me. I'm not sure who he is. We're gonna have to check and find out who Others is. And how bad do you feel if you're Huntsman, who has really some credentials, has spent money, has done a bunch of campaigning, and you get beat by someone named Others? Oh.
Not too encouraging.
Not too encouraging at all. I would have thought he would have been the guy to kind of kick out. Maybe Perry. I said Perry Santorum would be a nice kind of a fit because then you could bridge that gap with the Catholics.
Well, I do believe there's a bit of a sigh on the part of some in the business community, especially conservatives. They're a bit concerned about your girlfriend, Michelle, who has made a promise that she will never vote to lift the debt. That's disconcerting to business people because they understand the consequences of that. Now you have the governor of Texas who, in some ways, is close to, they're pretty close in some of their positions. But so far, he hasn't taken that position. And I think if he has smart advisors, they will tell him not to say what she said. I mean, that's absolutely crazy to say she will never vote to lift the national.
Never.
That is absolutely economic suicide.
We'll let those poor people starve to death. Anyway, I got an email during the break. you got to love this. He writes, maybe Perry will raise a stink about Kasich stealing all of his rain. Or rain, since I missed the baseball game yesterday, get it?
I got it.
Because most of Texas is in drought conditions right now. Nothing is growing. In fact, there's some pretty big concern down there. Interesting email. Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. We're right back after this.
Thank you.
Rick Smith Show.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make this way happen.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember to check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So what's going on? I guess today the big bus tour kicks off.
Yes, the big bus tour. President Obama kicked off his Midwestern bus tour today, blasting his would-be opponents in what was really a campaign-style event in Minnesota. Now, White House officials say that Obama's trip is official business.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'll buy that.
Republicans say, no, it's not. But he did have politics on his mind because he actually did refer to the debate. He said, I know it's not election season yet, but I just have to mention the debate, he said at the town hall. And then he referenced where Republicans said last week that they wouldn't increase taxes under any circumstance virtually, including 10 to 1.
Yep.
He said, think about that. That's just not common sense.
Yeah, I knew when they asked the question and all the idiots all raised their hand, pretty much, again, shows there's no thought going through the space between their ears.
It's fascinating that they wouldn't go for that. I think Gingrich said he would go for that, didn't he?
He didn't really say. He raised his hand. He was there with everybody else. But he did say he would consider some things, I think, if I remember right.
Yeah, I think he did. I think he did.
But anyway, I find it interesting that he picked Minnesota to start. That's kind of an interesting place to start.
It is an interesting place to start. And he's sleeping overnight in Iowa. Now, Michelle Bachmann, who, of course, is from Iowa and won the straw poll, announced that she was going to be staying longer in Iowa, basically spending the week there. I think she's protecting Iowa with her honor.
She's going to have to. I mean, she's from the same hometown as John Wayne Gacy.
That's right. She is.
Which I'm surprised I haven't seen, at least one person following her everywhere she goes in a big clown outfit.
Maybe people have more taste.
I still think it would be funny.
It would be very funny.
But, I find it odd that, Minnesota is the place you're going to go.
It is odd. But I think he felt that, look, we've got to get out there. We've got to talk up jobs. We've got to talk up the economy. We've got to talk up strengthening the middle class. And he felt very strongly that he needed to do this. There was perfect weather, and he had this town hall.
Yep. I'm in favor of campaign Obama coming back. I've been begging and pleading for campaign Obama to return because I haven't really liked President Obama much.
Well, I think campaign Obama is coming back, and he tried out what I thought were a couple of themes. Not only did he talk about the various job-making schemes that are just standing by, that he said Congress could do that now, right now, and he had several of them. But he also, towards the end, as his voice rose, said, you've got to send a message to Washington that it's time for the games to stop. It's time to put country first. And then he said again, it's time for the games to stop.
I agree.
And then he went on to say that some folks in Congress would rather see their opponents lose than America win. And I think that this
nice.
Time for the games to stop and putting country first, which I think that was John McCain's message, that last bit anyway, I think that's going to be part of his theme.
Yeah, well, you know, I'd be happy if they put country first and forget about all these bizarre free trade agreements that they keep trying to ram down our throats.
Well, he did talk about the free trade agreement, I must say.
Yeah, I know. I know. I know all about it. I guess the president has sent the vice president out to sell the debt ceiling thing.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I guess Obama sent Biden to China to sell his debt deal.
That's right. He's going to China and he's going to Japan. And, well, I mean, you know, sometimes you have to go to the bank. And that's what he's doing. He's going to China on Wednesday. According to the Undersecretary of the Treasury, the Vice President will be in a good position to talk about the very strong deficit package that we concluded here recently.
Yeah, so strong it got us downgraded. Nice.
Yeah, and I guess that he's going to be sort of explaining that that doesn't really mean anything.
And I guess there's other expectations that are falling. I guess Moody's has thrown into the ring as well.
Yeah, Moody's is now this is a related Moody's. This is Moody's Analytics, which is related to Moody's Investor Services. But it's significantly lowered its hopes for the nation's economy through 2011. It did have a 3.5% growth expectation a month ago. As of today, its expected growth of the nation's gross domestic product is 2% for the remainder of the year.
Well, I mean, when you're cutting spending to the point where we're going to start laying off tens of thousands of people, of course your outlook is going to go down. When they're talking about laying off, basically firing 120,000 postal workers, what do you expect?
Well, it's quite considerable. I mean, it is quite considerable. Moody's also said that the recent drama on the economic front and, of course, the debt limit drama has eviscerated investor and business confidence.
I can't argue with that. What it shows me is that the people in Washington can't do their jobs. But here we go. I guess the White House is also sticking to their timetable with removing the troops from Iraq, even though today they're saying upwards of 80 people killed.
That's right. Now, the troops are scheduled to leave Iraq in December under the Status of Forces Agreement. But it is possible some forces could remain in Iraq if Iraq's government requests them. Although they are sort of hoping that if Iraq is going to do that, that they would actually sort of get on with it and ask, because
right.
It would take some time to organize this. But at the moment, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney is saying, obviously there have been attacks, we strongly condemn them, but it doesn't change where we are in the process of drawing down our troops, or change the fact that we are, as we have said, in discussions with the Iraqis. So he also notes that the general trend in Iraq is decreasing violence.
Well, I mean, you know, I just read a report here today. One of the vice presidents in Iraq, they said, you know, we want the U.S. out, and the fact that they're pulling troops out, he says is going to improve security, much as you've been saying. You know, it's trending downward. They're saying the same thing. The sooner you leave, the better.
Yeah, and yet there are two schools of thought about that. There are those who are very concerned that if the Americans do go, that it might trend upwards again. So there's a bit of a dispute in the government at the moment about it.
Yeah, well, when they start footing the bill, we don't have to start talking about cutting granny's Social Security or doing away with Medicare in order to defend them. Maybe there's a discussion to have down the road. But right now, I'm all in favor of gathering the sheep and getting the flock out.
Indeed.
And finally, they're targeting people who are helping make this Bin Laden film. There's a lot of talk about this film. What's going on with that?
Well, Representative Lynn Jenkins, Republican of Kansas, has the Stop Subsidizing Hollywood Act. And it would stop the Obama administration from spending taxpayer money to share information about the killing of Bin Laden with Sony Pictures.
They have nothing better to do in Kansas?
No, nothing.
Everything is perfect in Kansas. Well, that's where Dorothy, correct. That's where Dorothy's from. So obviously it is wonderful in Kansas.
Yeah. Jenkins says the bill's necessary because the government has no role to play in helping the movie industry at a time of fiscal crisis. If I may editorialize for a minute, apparently the movie industry isn't a real industry with real people with real jobs.
Well, no, you see, here's the thing, and this is where you're missing it. They're not real people with real jobs in Kansas.
Right. They're not real people because they're frou-frou people.
Well, they're those Hollywood people.
Yeah.
Those liberals.
Yeah, because they're never going to vote for Lynn Jenkins, even if they move to Kansas.
Well, at least we know. Victoria Jones, I appreciate the update. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Have a great night. And now to find out what we've got across the street. What's going on, Jake?
Thanks, Rick. That Warren Buffett article that you talked about, that was a fascinating article. I know you covered some of it, and you covered some of the facts and figures. Those are interesting. But I think it's very interesting to get in the mind of Warren Buffett and some of his ideas in this whole tax situation. And these are the comments and the thoughts of Warren Buffett, who, by the way, I believe is, at last count, I believe is the second richest man in America. These are his thoughts. I have worked with investors for 60 years, and I have yet to see anyone, not even when capital gain rates were 39.9% in 1976-77, shy away from a sensible investment because of the tax rate on the potential gain. People invest to make money, and potential taxes have never scared them off. And to those who argue that higher taxes hurt job creation, I would note that a net of nearly 40 million jobs were added between 1980 and 2000. You know what happened since then? Lower tax rates and far lower job creation. He also went on to say, I know very many of the mega rich, and by and large, they're very decent people. They love America and appreciate the opportunity this country has given them. Many have joined the giving pledge, promising to give most of their wealth to philanthropy. Most wouldn't mind being told to pay more in taxes as well, particularly when so many of their fellow citizens are truly suffering. In other words, what he's saying is we can tax the wealthy at a better rate that's fair to all of us, and at the same time you're not going to hurt investment. And the truth is that many of those who are wealthy and who Mr. Buffett knows believe, as he does, that they have an obligation to pay back to the country which allowed them to be wildly successful. And I absolutely 100% concur. And we need more people like Warren Buffett.
I don't know that his wealthy friends want to pay more taxes. I think that they could afford to. I think that they most certainly could do without the seventh or eighth vacation home. While there are people in this country getting kicked out of their first one. I think he's right, and we talked about that a little bit earlier. Fact of the matter is, no matter what the tax rate is, if there's an investment out there that's going to make money, you're going to do it. If there's an ability to make money by investing, they're going to continue to do it. This whole idea that we can give his class all this money, I mean, we've really proven this over the years, that the more we give to Buffett and to people like him, the less it actually helps us. The more we say, no, you're going to have to chuck in. And I had this conversation earlier today. Back when the tax rates were 92%, back in 1953 at the top marginal rate, we saw people investing. They still were doing it. They were still out there making money because, there were some people who paid pretty high tax rates. Why? Because they were still making money. The tax rate, to me, has nothing to do with it. I had to advocate going to a very high top marginal rate so folks use that money instead of continually hoarding it. During the 50s, you had the 92% rate that nobody paid because they used the money. They built schools. They built hospitals. They did all that stuff domestically. And that's what it should be. We should be with policy saying, by all means, use your money.
Well, I think what you have to understand about the wealthy, when they say a goodbye, they're going to go after many of them. Buy, especially certain stocks, if they're blue chip, they buy and hold. And the percentage of taxes is almost irrelevant to them. And by the way, I think Warren Buffett deserves even more credit than what we're giving him. I know he did. He was one of the very wealthy that went down Congress and testified on the inheritance tax. And he said, no, that was another issue. He said, look, he said, the very, very wealthy have prospered beyond their wildest dreams because of the conditions that existed in this country. And we have an obligation to pay our fair share. And if you people eliminate this, like you're going to hurt in the long term. You're going to hurt the economy of this nation. And thankfully, there were some people that listened to him. Horizon workers, we're trying to do everything we can here to help them out. If there are any of our listeners, Rick, that are listening in from D.C., I would quick want to go over some of the rallies. On Tuesday and Wednesday. On Tuesday, if any of you are living down around Silver Springs, on Tuesday at 12 in Montgomery County at 13101 Columbian Pike, there'll be a rally at 12 noon. Also at 12 noon in Washington, D.C., in the Street Verizon Wireless Store, that's at 1714 L Street Northwest, that's 1744 L Street Northwest. On Wednesday, F Street Verizon Wireless Store at 1314 F Street Northwest, and also on Thursday, L Street Verizon Wireless Store at 1744 L Street Northwest. So any of you guys down there in the Washington, D.C. area, please get out and support these people. These people are fighting for their economic life.
All righty, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap things up. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Smith Show.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK. You know, I was looking at this story a little bit earlier, and it's talking about the military retirement system. You know, the reality is I guess now we're no longer, we no longer think Social Security and Medicare is untouchable. So now they're going after, some folks want to go after a radical overhaul of the military retirement system. CBS News reported earlier today that, you know, they want to go and change how the whole eligibility for retirement is calculated. It is, you know, if you do 20 years, you get half your salary. Well, what they want to do now, and I'm going to love to hear what the military folks think about this, good luck, 20 years in, 401k for you from now on. So no more we value our heroes and no more we want our soldiers and all that stuff. You can have a 401k just like everyone else, and they're saying over 20 years it's going to save somewhere around $250 billion. So again, you know, I guess nothing really is sacred now that we're talking about cut, gut, and punish. So it'll be interesting to see where that discussion goes. What do you think?
I agree with you.
It's always nice to be ditto head. All right. For the fifth day in a row, evidently this afternoon, this 25-year-old man in Tulsa, Oklahoma, has refused to come down off of the communication tower that he's been sitting on. They don't know why. They originally thought he was trying to commit suicide, but they're saying, well, we don't know. Honestly, you know, if he wants to jump, he'll jump. You know, they keep telling him, hey, you know, dehydration is something you should worry about. It happens at the cellular level, can't be denied. That's what the chief negotiator there was saying, but the guy just wanted some Sprite, Dr. Pepper, and Rooster Booster and a cappuccino. And I'm like, well, why are you giving him anything? You know, I look at this story and I'm going, you know, they've got cops around this guy all day long. And I'm like, why? He's up on the tower, let him sit there. You know, if he comes down, he'll come. When he gets thirsty or has to go to the bathroom, maybe he comes down. Way too much resource. I'm worried about somebody sitting up on a tower. You know, maybe the 300 feet in the air he's sitting up. So, you know, if he wants to come down, they'll know where to find him. Another interesting story. Evidently, there are a bunch of websites out there where rich guys can go find broke women. SeekingArrangements.com bills itself as the premier sugar daddy dating site. So here you go, Jake. You can find yourself a hot young thing. Just put up a couple of bucks. It's pretty expensive, though. For the lowest plan, $50 a month, $1,000 for a year to certify your wealth, and you too can find some hot young thing to run around with.
For
$1,000 up front, that's just for the certifying the wealth. $50 a month for the account, and then of course you're going to have to pay for your poor woman, you know, you're going to have to give her a monthly stipend. And, you know, basically, this is one of those taking care of sites.
So, excuse me, I have to certify my wealth.
Well, yeah.
And it's going to cost me $1,000.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I bet you the guys are just lined up for that one.
Well, you know, they claim they're making big money here. And the reality is, you get these old guys who got a lot of money and they want some pretty little young thing to put on their arm. They're just bringing people together. It kind of sounds like prostitution to me, but they're saying, no. We're not a prostitution service. We're just bringing people together.
It's kind of like the Sugar Daddy Network.
Well, that's what they've said.
Okay.
That's how they bill themselves.
All right.
And they say that, you know, these women, you know, will come and, you know, stay with you, and they get a monthly allowance, anywhere from $1,000 to $20,000 a month. And, you know, kind of sounds like prostitution to me, but
they get an allowance. Okay.
There are others who would say that it's just like marriage.
I'm chuckling here.
Well, there are some who say it sounds just like marriage. You give over half your paycheck every week anyway, so maybe, who knows. But there you go. So when you go home, make sure you sign up for SeekingArrangements.com. I mean, you're loaded over there.
Uh-huh.
You can, you know, have a lifestyle with a young, beautiful companion. Just a couple of bucks. It's only money, Jay. Come on. Here's a kind of like something I would do. This guy who evidently lived in Massachusetts at one point in his life, in Stoughton, he lives in Mississippi. And when he went back to Massachusetts recently, he went to his favorite pizza shop, which is the Town Spa Pizza, pizza shop there. And he ordered 150 pizzas to be frozen so he could take them back to Mississippi with him so that whenever he feels longing for home, he can get one of his, you know, Town Spa Massachusetts pizzas, pop it in the oven, and there you go. You know, it's like we had gone to Pittsburgh not too long ago, and Brett, the producer, came to the supermarket with me where they had my favorite bread. And you can't get it here. It's something that they make in Cleveland. And I bought, I think, 12 or 14 loaves, and everybody's looking at me like I'm strange. Like, what's this guy doing with all this bread? And I'm going, well, put it in the freezer. So when I want, so I'm bread, there I got it. So I understand the 150 pizza thing. I get that. The sugar daddy thing, not so much. That's a lot of money. And they were saying upwards of, you know, 20 grand, you know, a year for the service. I mean, the money, but again, if you're one of these multimillionaires, what's 20 grand? If we're like you, you know, all the money you got sitting around, you know, collecting dust, sign right up. There you go. I keep getting these emails. Have you been seeing these of this Chinese aircraft? That they're not real pictures. They're cartoons. You know, they're like drawings of this virtual Chinese aircraft. And I guess we're pimping defense again. And no one wants to say, hold on, we're spending too much. Because all of the, if, you know, what if China attacks, or what if the Russians and the Chinese attack, and so on. But they got this really nice aircraft carrier, or so it looks in the drawings. And the whole idea of the email is to scare the hell out of us, so that we say, no cuts to defense. And, you know, I look at this story from Agency France Presse. In Iraq, who had a horrible day, I guess 80 people killed, their vice president, this Tariq al-Hashimi, said on Sunday, look, we want folks out. He said that the U.S. could provide training expertise for new defense equipment, but that other countries offered the same technology at lower prices, so they might go that route. So, again, you know, we're getting screwed in all this. And we're now still talking about cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, cutting military pensions, and we're still in Iraq. And the president said, well, we're going to still be there. We're going to continue on our timetable. White House also said today that they remain committed to Taiwan. If you remember back in the 50s, Eisenhower sent the Pacific Fleet to surround Taiwan. I wonder if we'll do that again. I doubt it. But Joe Biden, I guess, is going over to have a discussion. And, you know, look, they're saying, you know, because of the Taiwan Relations Act in 1979, they have to defend Taiwan. And I look at this and I'm going, do you think we really will? I mean, do you think we will?
Well, you know what? I'm not so sure China wants really needs that land anymore. I'm a little skeptical of them being a danger to nationalist China, really. I mean, they've developed into such a power. Do they really need those two? Those are two small islands, actually, Kamoi and Matsu. I'm not so sure that mainland China cares anymore, Rick.
Economic powerhouses. Lots of money there. Anyway, we shall see. Tomorrow, again, we'll be back. We're going to head back over to the picket line to talk to the folks over at CWOA. And I say, you know, if you see one of the folks on the line, beep your horn, say hello. If you can stop by, drop off, you know, something to drink, a cup of coffee, a donut, something. Show your solidarity, show your support. I'm going to be there, and I hope you will, too, until this is all over. Because, again, as I've said, this is that battle. This is that battle that I think we'll look back on in 10, 15 years and say one way or another, win, loss, that's where things either started to go right or that's where things continued to go horribly, horribly wrong. And if you missed any portion of the program, go to thericksmithshow.com and download our podcast. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can download the Stitcher app and take your program on the go. Also, if you've got a question, comment, something on your mind, something ticks you off about something I said, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow night.
Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
We believe in you, Madison.